But I never met that person. That's why I'm.
I want to thank all of you for the punctuality. I went out, although I was here before some of you, just to make sure the chairperson comes in last. So I went out for that reason. Finally, I observed some hugs between the presenters and honorable members. All hugs must be approved DFS before they have to have the process. An honorable member says that his pen is done jealousy. I take this opportunity to welcome honorable members and thank you for being in these large numbers. And I also take time to welcome LIS members and also CANSA. Presentations will start with LIS and then there will be discussions, and after that we release them, and then there will be briefing by Pansal. We're not saying when LIS are done, we're chasing them away. Portfolio committee meetings are public. They are open unless declared otherwise. So you're not forced to leave after your presentation. Any apologies? We have received an apology from Honorable Lishiva, who's consulting with the doctor. And the minister is attending cabinet. So, thank you very much. How much time do you need, LIS?
For
the presentation, the one needs more than 50 minutes. 50 minutes. Yes. And then, but after that, we'll ask about 10 minutes to emphasize the meeting. So, all you want more than 50 minutes.
Okay, thank you. That's reasonable. You may proceed. But before
we do that, we want honorable members to introduce themselves, and then you'll introduce yourself and your delegation.
Thank you, Dr. Sam. My name is Sophia Lobo from Sumalanga, and I'm sitting on the portfolio of the country. Thank you.
Montu Commando from the ANC Country, a member of the Agriculture Committee.
I'm Shenwani Farisani. Thank you. LIS.
Thank you, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members. My name is Pulen Jutana from the Department of Agriculture. I'm going to introduce the delegation and Professor Nkondo will make the presentation. Professor Nkondo is the chair of the National Library Board. He's also the chair of the technical committee that drafted the transformation charter, mandated by the National Council for Library Information Services. Close to him is president of the Library Association, Rachel Moore. She's also the deputy chair, deputy national librarian. Next to her is the head of the Center for the Book, which is a unit in the National Library.
Can you just raise your hand? Thank you.
And close to him is Hefi Hafadi. He's a member of the Executive Committee of the National Council for National Information Services. Thank you.
From Pansal, so that we finish introductions once and for all.
Thank you very much. My name is Sihao Mbubane. I'm the chairperson of the Center of Seven Language and Sport. With me, I have the deputy chairperson, Professor Gordo Mota. And Leva Lostation is Ms. Mbaz. And our ACPO, Chris Quick. Thank you very much.
May those who have not introduced themselves introduce themselves? I think we have a few here who have not introduced themselves.
You could be the PMG.
What does PMG mean?
Parliamentary Monitoring Group.
I'll go to the mic.
Parliamentary Monitoring Group.
Thank you.
My name is Abin Medicine from ACBC Radio. We have planned committee.
Thank you very much. Now we know one another. We are on item 3, LIS presentation.
Thank you very much, the Honorable Chairperson of the Committee and Honorable Members. We really appreciate the opportunity to come and present the charter. We are also mindful of the time constraints and which you all the offer, so we're going to be very quick about it. If you can just wait to the slide that comes. That outline gives you briefly that how we have structured the charter, we start with the background, shows the purpose of the charter, analytical framework, methodology, challenges and interventions, and then we list the key challenges. First one, national non-standard, we talk about them briefly. There are governance challenges, education training, how to invest in people, protect the needs, the most vulnerable, including people with disabilities, access and participation challenges, the challenge of cultural reading and the transformation of legal culture, and how to ensure effective implementation. One challenge that we have omitted here, but which appears later, which I would like you to add is underfunding of the sector. Underfunding of the sector. It comes next week. Background, in April 2008, the National Council for Library and Information Services, in consultation with the Department of Arts and Culture, brought together seven people to form the Library and Information Services Transformation Team. Introduce the members in absentia, Professor Lesive Jotefo, who when we were working on this was the executive dean of the Faculty of the Humanities at the University of Limpopo. He's currently the director at the Human Science Research Council. We have Professor Mary Nesimbeni, who is a professor of Library and Human Services at the University of Cape Town. We have Professor Yona Sileti, formerly Professor of History at the University of KZN, currently the Chief Director in the Department of Science and Technology, focusing on indigenous knowledge systems. And we have Professor Archie Dick, who is a Professor of Library and Services at the University of Pretoria. Also Professor Genevieve Hart, who is a Professor of Library and Services at the University of Cape. And Miss Anna Brown, who is in the Department of Education, how things are going. Scope and purpose of the charter. Our assignment was to define the challenges facing the sector and to provide a framework for effecting the changes for the sector to contribute to the elimination of illiteracy, eradication of inequality in the sector, promotion of social cohesion, and building an informed and leading nation. Then we had a very extensive shareholder consultation in line with national policy trends in the country to consult extensively. First, we had the meetings held in each of the 9 provinces from May to July 2008. We had very extensive consultations that on each case we ran for a full day, making sure that we reached every possible public involved with the sector. Then the minister briefed SALGAS and the committee on NESFE to the May. Then we had presentations at the IASA conference in Cape Town, October 2008. The IASA conference brings the entire sector into the leadership and the practitioners of the entire sector. We meet once a year on their occasion to address them. Then there was a NESFE summit in Pretoria, 57 to 97, to address all the stakeholders that brought together here. There was a briefing of the National Council for Library and Human Services in January 2009, and then we had a briefing after that, the briefing of Minister of Agriculture, who was really helping with our draft charter. And because the school in libraries fall under education, we had to brief the Minister of Education, was also very, very happy with it. And after that, we briefed him in the camp in February 2009. And we made sure that in the occasion we really went out to reach everybody, particularly in the rural areas. It was not easy, but make sure that we reach every people. Also, quite difficult, we were trying to reach the youth and the students, but we tried our best. I think if you look at the charter, we do spell out the problems with methodology, but on that later. Then comes the analytical framework.
Yes, just before you pass it, the MINMEC, what department was that?
Agriculture.
Thank you.
Analytical framework, Honorable Chair, together the 12 chapters lay out a structure of practical reasoning to guide librarians, managers of educational institutions and public officials, specifically on what they should see and do, to exploit the particular circumstances they find themselves in to enhance the public value of libraries. To achieve this purpose, the charter develops several different kinds of First, it sets out an idea of what citizens should of librarians and public officials involved in the sector, the political, professional, and ethical responsibilities they assume in taking office, and what constitutes success in the execution of their work. Second, it sets out in broad outline an analytical framework to guide librarians and managers of healthcare institutions in analyzing the situation in which they operate and assessing the potential for effective action. The charter identifies particular kinds of interventions they can make to exploit the potential of their political and institutional settings for enhancing efficiency and effectiveness. Methodology will be something that honorable members should, I'm sure, have looked at very, very close, because it's on this section of the charter that the argument has succeeded or failed. The charter is grounded in the context of the South African government in the last 6 years. It is based on extensive public consultations in the international community, interviews with scholars and practitioners, as well as on available academic literature that is relevant to understanding the context, purposes, and methods of librarian managers of education institutions. Challenges and interventions. The charter calls for institutional reform and changes in how librarians and managers of education institutions do their work. One, the summary national norms and standards. We will make a case for this, and that is very important. Then there are some very, very serious governance issues. The problem of education and training, how to invest in people, particularly in poor rural areas. Protect the most vulnerable, particularly people with disabilities, and for the whole question of African participation. Culture of reading and the transformation of national culture, and of course, ensure dissemination. Earlier, this adds an extra challenge to the underfunding of the sector. Just a brief comment on each of those challenges. A, legal norms and standards at the core of the transformation challenge is the lack of national policy on norms and standards. Honorable Chair, a lot hangs on that. I'm going to ask my colleague with others to speak briefly on that. It's very, very urgent. I want to impress upon the honorable members the agency of the sector. Two, governance. Key to the governance challenges are overlapping mandates and the lack of capacity to transform the sector in line with the Bill of Rights and applicable national policy. In this regard, legislation has to be reviewed to eliminate overlaps and confusion at the point of implementation. Again, I'll ask my colleague, Ms. Alfred, to speak about one or two minutes. Third challenge, education and training, investing in people. Again, this is a red flag in the charter. It is in this challenge. The future of the sector lies in its human resources. Indeed, the sector must solve its training, recruitment, and retention crisis. It is to contribute to national development and the achievement of the Millennium Development Goals. The South African curriculum, in its efforts and its pedagogy, cannot be delivered without access to well-managed collections of resources. We are going to come in and talk specifically to the challenge of school fees, libraries, and the lack of a polyglot school library. Protect the most vulnerable people with disabilities. Government should enforce the United Nations Convention on the Rights and Protection of Disabilities, in terms of which the sector should develop a rights and inclusion policy framework. E, access and participation as part of a wider set of measures to achieve equality and justice. The sector must ensure free and easy access for all the library needs. F, culture of reading and transformation of national culture. To develop a culture of reading, steps should be taken to mobilize TV and other forms of mass media in a campaign to resocialize workers, especially children and youth, within the framework of values provided by the Consumer White Paper on Value People. The other memory institutions, the archives and museums, should be advised to develop their own chapters, because if they don't, to really compromise. You can go to three institutions organically linked to each other. G, how to ensure effective implementation if the sector is to take responsibility for its own development as a chief. The library, any point of South Africa, and the National Council for Library and Information Services must be given good authority on issues that concern them. I've asked my colleague, Ms. Rachel Morris, to speak about adequate funding must be provided. And an independent monitoring and evaluation system must be established to make sure this happens. And at the end of the chapter, we will have a whole section, the whole chapter, for step-by-step implementation of these recommendations. Then in the last 10 years or so, there's been some major achievements. It's so easy for Gatine to find fault limitations. And usually we leave out achievements in the sector. Here we are saying, in the last 10 years, the community library census grant, which is making a big difference, that is about 1 billion rand that has made a certain impact. The performance of the two, that the drafting of this chart. Three, we are now reprinting the African Literature Club. I think we have come up with the third volume. We are going to our second volume. But we are aware of how indigenous African language and literature are underappreciated. I think we are getting prominent. As you may be aware, we are drafting the South African Community Library and Information Bill. I'm sure it's going to serve before you sometime this semester. I think next semester. And that bill provides the legal framework for national norms. And what we left out there is that we commissioned the KPMG to do a comprehensive audit on community libraries, and they produce a brilliant report. Those are some of the major achievements that the sector is proud of, and would like the honorable members to take note of that. Finally, I want to thank you very much. Our vision, as you can see there, is towards the best performance mission. If you look at our strategic plan, trying to make sure that we produce an informed nation of the best in the world. Anyway, and now, Honorable Chair, let me ask my colleague, Ms. Harper, to do the following. Talk to the challenge of underfunding, talk to the challenge of non-sustainment, and talk to the challenge of governance. There's one item under legislative framework which will cause problems, and that is the problem we have with the Copyright Act as it is now. And then how you speak to that portion. Thank you very much.
Can I continue, Honorable Chair?
Please do.
Honorable Chair, Honorable Members of the Committee, I'm going to focus on three main issues: the funding model, governance, and non-sustainment. The funding model. It became quite evident early in the investigation that the LIS sector was seriously underfunded in all respects, that is, infrastructure, equipment, staff and material. Libraries have been seriously underfunded both as a government sector and within organizations. There is no funding framework or funding model that would ensure that there is sufficient budget allocation for the provision of accessible and resource library and information services to meet the constitutional requirements of an informed nation within the growing knowledge economy. The analysis of the current funding model clearly shows that the inadequacy of funding structures, the amount allocated, and the capacity of the sector to plan for a robot LIS services for the knowledge economy. One of the challenges that has beleaguered the public library sector in our country was that the national funding via the National Departments of Arts and Culture amounted to some 50 million rand per year for the financial years 2002-2003, up to and including the financial years 2006 and 2007. This, of course, has changed dramatically with the allocation of the 1 billion rand additional funding, more commonly known as a conditional grant, for the years starting 2007 and 2008. In the public sector, the spending burden on our libraries had been carried by the 6 metro cities, leaving most of the municipalities with minuscule expenditures on LIS. In addition, it must be remembered that the local municipal budgets tend to spend largely on recurrent expenditures such as salaries. The South African National Library budget per capita at $3 per year is low in comparison with Australia, which is $42, the UK, which is $36, Canada, which is $18, and Finland, which is $12. There is an urgent need for a new funding model, and there needs to be legislative changes that provide for funding from DAC to be folded into the provincial equitable share allocation that is LIS specific on a province by province basis. Governance. There is serious need for clarification since there exists an overlapping of library mandates across government sectors. There is no policy on the clear allocation of roles, responsibilities, and mandates, especially at local government level. The present structure of the sector is not conducive to effective service delivery. There is a lack of coherent policies and strategies to integrate libraries into the fabric of community. Also in terms of government, the Copyright Act No. 98 of 1978 needs amendments in regard to copying and access to information. Copyright laws must be fair to ensure a balance between the interests of commercial and non-commercial publishers on the one hand, with the public interest on the other. Special provisions in the Act should be made for libraries, education, literary training, interlibrary loans, preservation and access by persons with sensory disabilities will serve to transform the sector. Norms and standards. Norms and standards for service delivery in the different LIS sectors are seriously lacking. Norms and standards are needed in regard to services, management, staffing, resources, infrastructure, ICT, and access. The framework for the determination of minimum norms and standards needs to be benchmarked internally against guidelines provided by IFLA, the International Federation of Library Associations, UNESCO, and the International Standards Organization. One of the recommendations of the study was to develop legislation on norms and standards for the LIS. In this regard, I am pleased to report that the draft South African Community Library and Information Bill has already entered the legislative process. This legislation will provide a framework for national norms and standards. Thank you, Honorable Chair.
Thank you.
Honorable Chair and Honorable Members, thank you for the opportunity. I want to speak briefly on the challenges which are facing the library and information profession. We have realized that generally there is a deprofessionalization of the library profession because more and more organizations are employing non-librarians to manage libraries. This has led to a great impact on the quality of the library services and failure to promote the appreciation of libraries and what they stand for. The reasons driving institutions to employ unqualified librarians in professional positions requires unraveling in order to provide understanding and an establishment of this trend. But this continues to reduce the library service standards. Another challenge facing the profession is the low status of the profession, which is really leading to the shrinking numbers of new entrants to the profession. And as a result, most library schools have closed down. And of course, as I said, it leads to too few new library professionals entering the profession. We also have a challenge of high staff turnover because of the low salaries paid to librarians. There is high mobility within the sector. Another challenge is that librarianship is often referred to as an aging profession because the leadership of the profession is now in the hands of the retiring baby boomers who are retiring with their experience, their skills, and their knowledge. This has posed challenges for the library and information profession, LIASA, which is a national professional association which aims to unite and develop and empower all people in the library and information field and organize them into an organization that provides dynamic leadership in transforming, developing, and sustaining the library and information services in the country. LIASA advocates and supports the provision of an efficient, user-oriented, and excellent library and information services that aspire equitable access to information for all communities in South Africa. It also represents the interest and promotes the development and image of the library and information professionals locally, provincially, and nationally to government and other agencies. LIASA also represents the LIS sector at international level. As a Library Information Association in South Africa, we have also provided the world with a leader in the sense that the present president of the International Federation of Library Associations is a South African, Ms. Ellen Tai. So this was a great achievement for our Library and Information Association in South Africa. So in order to deal with the challenges which I have just alluded to, a decision was taken by the Library Information Association of South Africa to explore the possibility of turning LIASA into a statutory body in order to help address the challenges I have just mentioned. So at the moment, there are consultations going on in order to ensure that all the library and information workers are consulted on changing LIASA into a statutory body. Thank you.
Quickly, Honorable Chair, Ms. Ellen Tyne, who is the president of IFLA, is the librarian in the University of Stellenbosch. And belatedly, we have to apologize for the absence of the major librarian, the John Turner, who's attending a conference in Bulgaria.
Does this exhaust your presentation? Thank you very much. We have one honorable member who has not introduced herself. It turns out my left.
I'm Desiree Panavon, the member of the committee from the DA and also from the book.
Thank you. Honorable members, time for questions and comments. Honorable Lotrich and Honorable Schwarzen.
Thank you, Chair. First of all, Professor Nkondo and your team, I have to congratulate you on the work done. I think this is crucial, and I think we can't get our country to read the United States Books for Life. And therefore, books play such a crucial role, our information services, our library. But it is quite disconcerting the challenges that you mentioned, because I know they are there, and they are, I think, very tricky, and you'll have to look at very creative ways to overcome them. I would perhaps just want some elaboration, because in this charter I did pick up quite a substantial bit on the whole issue pertaining to schools. And I think much of our culture of reading also starts at schools and are dependent on schools. Now, you referred to a bit earlier to the whole question of overlapping mandates and legislation, perhaps also, I think sometimes not overlapping, but also working across purposes. Does this include the education sector as well? Because I think there should be quite close collaboration. So if you could just give a bit more of an elaboration on that.
Honorable Chairman.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. And the presenter who is sort of like it was an eye open. I tell what is happening. I'm reckoning up by one has a problem, more especially when it comes to the rural communities. The ones who know that they were really disadvantaged by the previous system. Up to now, we find that a lot of things are happening. You wonder why our children roaming around, what they're doing. You may think that maybe it is the cause that there's nothing which is very entertaining to them. Because knowledge is power. If they're not reading, there's no interest in anything. So one would like to know, because time and again when you visit schools, they complain of libraries. We don't have libraries here in our school. And we still don't have an answer when libraries is going to be erected there or to be given to those kids. In more especially the principal. Even the children themselves, they complain about libraries. One would like maybe to have a statistic, how many libraries are built in rural areas. We still have a community library, not community library, community art centers, which maybe they can be utilized as libraries somehow. So one has that problem. And then I don't know whether the library, the dictionaries, I remember one time when we were having that one-day conference for translating, it was the one question for us. We were never fed what is the development, the progress there. Because if you don't have translation or translated words, you're going to turn. I know that Dr. Dallas was the language, but let's be. Translation, so that when children read whatever they are reading, they must be able to understand.
Thank you, Prof, for announcing that librarianship is an aging profession. So I know where to go when I retire in a few years' time, reaching retirement age. Although there's no retirement age in politics, but I'm very comfortable with that. Honorable Taban.
Thank you, Honorable Sir. My question is, as the board has offered this honorable lady, I think that there are some challenges, and that for me, they sound very severe. What I want to find out now from the board members is, are there any solutions or suggestions that you have as a board more particularly when it comes to the payment of Nepalians, because really, I know some of them, their salaries really is competitive. And secondly, they have a very good relation, and I've been trying to shut down as well to the team, and then I left out, even I was left out, because as I'm trying to write down, they are now proceeding, I'm leaving now some points there, want to shut down. Can they, is it possible that they can give us what they have presented here today in writing so that they can go through having time to do so? Thank you.
Yeah, another problem, I find, now you mentioned low salaries, I have to reconsider my availability. Honorable Van der Waal.
Okay, sorry, I do apologize for not being in this place. I just have a major concern on libraries, and I know libraries is not only the competency of the specific discussion we're having. But, you know, I have now seen myself sitting here up in this committee. We keep on discussing libraries. The implementation, however, if you put the value to that, it's getting lower instead of higher. And the 1 million rand, I think if I remember correctly, was over to be posted over 3 years. Minister David Jordan. And I can recall seeing money going to provinces. I was not so sure that I ever saw that that metros were the only ones that really benefited. And if that is true, I think the committee should be made aware of that that's exactly where did that 1 billion rand that was supposed to go to, so we can evaluate that and play the oversight role on that as we're supposed to. So I'm very concerned, except on the fact of every school should have a library, as it should have a lab or science, etc. It's our community library. I think if we don't have money for community libraries, we've got to consider going back to mobile library. It's a cheaper way, if implemented in the right way and controlled properly, obviously. But see, you and I and Mama Savita, we all come from rural provinces, and it's not only the rural people, they are very poor people. Is coming from the honourable Shivaji, is coming from the white communities as well. But a huge number of scholars actually after school go to community libraries in town. They actually use that as a study place because they don't have electricity at home, they don't have the facilities, and a huge number in the rural provinces actually have parents who aren't literate, who can't assist them with their homework. And if those libraries are accessible, they are available and accessible, and they do have the right material, including the new latest technology and so on, we would have better results at schools as well. But I really am extremely concerned that we don't have a proper audit of this in every single municipal area in this country. Really, really, audits cost a lot of money, but there are easy ways to get those audits done by municipalities. And I really think we should embark on this and start implementing the change that we've been talking about going now for the 7th year in this committee. Thank you, Chair.
We'll take in the last question to make them five. Honorable Professor, there was a protest about your name. What happened?
Instead of
we have 11 official languages. In the language she used, maybe that's how the name is pronounced. Thank you. Let's take up the last question.
Thank you, Chairperson. I don't want to talk about bringing back the culture of reading, especially in our community. That we've got libraries in our community. We don't take libraries for the school children, but we can maybe come up with a campaign to bring back the culture of reading, even to the elders who stay in our, especially the places where I came from. I came from Soweto, libraries around our community. That maybe can, that thing to bring back the culture of reading to elders can make sure that sometimes when my granddaughter or grandson go to the library, I can say, can I accompany you? And when I go there, I know that I'll find a book to read, my language. I can find a book like I can maybe borrow that book and go back home and read that book, you know, just to bring back that culture of reading even to our elderly people, to make sure that the library is not only for the school, you can get some books even for the elderly people. Thank you.
We'll deal with those five questions.
Well, thank you very much, Honorable Chair, and thank you very much, Honorable. Just a very important point about the statistical thing. I think it's important that we highlight it. We devote a whole chapter, chapter 5 of this book, devoted to the school library, the school library. And we did that because we appreciated the agency involved in it. You know, as our leading expert on this process, you never know how to do the chapter. If you look very carefully at that chapter, yeah, this is how bleak the situation is. In the Eastern Cape, only 2.9% of schools functioning library. In the Free State, 8.8% of schools are functioning. In Gauteng, 18.4%. KZN, 6.1%. Limpopo, 2.3%. Mpumalanga, 6.1%. Northern Cape, 2.3, Northwest 6.4, Western Cape 25%. All in all, only 2.7% of schools in this country have functioning library. That's how bleak. And this happens, Honorable Chair, when we are embarked on outcomes-based education. And as all know, outcome-based education is resource-based. You've got to have reference material, you've got to have accessible, you know, learning resources for children, for students to do their project. It's project-oriented and resource-based. So there is an inbuilt contradiction between the curriculum philosophy of the country and the availability of resources. It is this inbuilt tension that is so fundamental going forward. And that's why we feel this has to be addressed at the middle of agency. I also want to say that, you know, when we presented the charter to the Minister of Education, then the Honorable Minister Kando, it is very, very important that there be a national policy on school libraries. It is really tragic that 16 years after our independence, we still don't have a policy on school libraries. That is very, very, very serious. And we really want to urge the honorable members to take this up as a question. It's very important that that be done. And also, if you look very carefully, it means that we are failing to redress the historical inequality. All of those areas where there are already people, you know, better educated, better off communities, that is Gauteng, Western Cape, and KZ in the urban areas. But out there, the situation is bleak now as it was in 1994. This presentation. I want to ask my colleagues to deal with
the
overlapping mandates
again. Professor Mkondo, we are lucky that we are a democracy such talk about failure of government, I would land you in prison under the Communism Act or terrorism. But you did it even that. So we have the forbid.
Honorable Chair, Honorable Knight, I just want to add a few things to what President Conrad had to say. As he stated very clearly, there is no national school library policy. However, recently there is a very good school library policy in KZN, which is now in existence. Two, because there are so few school libraries, the drain on public libraries has become quite drastic. But only in those areas, of course, where public libraries are available to school children, not where they aren't. With the result that the public library's original mandate was not to provide for school children. But now they have really no choice. Because the kids walk in there and there's nothing you can do. And that's where the conflict of the mandates comes in. And we need to be very clear about norms and standards for school libraries so we can set the same thing. But it's also very interesting to note recently that there is a cooperation between some school libraries and some public libraries where they're joining their resources so that the school children can get the most out of it. But generally, we need to get those mandates right. Thank you.
Honorable Chair, I want to ask my colleagues to make a moment to talk about the payment to librarians and also an assessment of the conditional contract.
An announcement. If we see Honorable Ndapane and everything, it's because he has to attend a chief whip's meeting. And when he's through, he'll come back, it will still be. And Honorable Maluleke, from time to time, may be out of here because of ill health. So we'll understand that.
Let me ask our colleague who will come to talk to give a quick assessment of the cultural crisis.
Thank you, Papa. Thank you, Honorable Chair. The conditional grant really is going to make an impact. The money is transferred to provinces as a Schedule 5 conditional grant. And provinces manage the implementation of the program. In some provinces, the funding is transferred to municipalities. In some provinces, the provinces themselves actually implement the focus. But the focus area for the conditional grant is really and truly to build new facilities where there are none and to upgrade some of the facilities and also to ensure that there is new materials and new in the libraries. And one of the most important outputs also is the issue of ICT. In terms of internet seminars for the public and so on. Thank you.
Have you exhausted your responses?
No.
Maybe exhaust them and she will decide whether she wants to follow up. Honorable Mayor.
Then, Honorable Chair, I want to call Ms. Mohammed to talk about the payment. Make sure you are good for a draft in the human chair.
As I mentioned, the low salaries spent by librarians is a real challenge, and it has created a mass exodus from the profession. With a library professional,
if you know the range of the low salaries, please benefit us or the average benefit us. So
okay.
You might find that the low salary is higher than the salary earned by honorable
members. Okay, the salaries also, another challenge is that the salaries also differ from area to area, but the salary scales of a new a professional librarian just coming from school will range between from about 89,000 per annum to up to 107 per annum, the entry grade. And there are librarians who have been more than 30 years in the profession, still aiming around 130 per annum. As librarians, we are very, very passionate about building the culture of reading, and especially also the appreciation for libraries, because we believe that libraries is a hub and a heart of every community. Also, as a library and information sector, we are equally passionate about building the culture of reading, and we usually use the Library Week, which is celebrated annually during the month of March, to build a culture of reading. For example, during this year, the theme for the South African Library Week was Reading Changes Lives. And we made sure that throughout all the provinces, there is a awareness about the importance of reading. We also, during that month, had a campaign for Every Child a Book, whereby we encouraged parents as well as organizations to donate books so that we ensure that every child has a book during that month, so that even in their families, the books can be read to them, because we believe that a reading child will easily become a reading adult. Thank you.
Honorable Chair, there was a question on the use of mobile libraries. I think we are able to report that in quite a few provinces, particularly provinces that are predominantly rural, like the Northern Cape, Northwest, Mpumalanga, there's quite significant use of mobile libraries. I think that is. But the problem of a library is how to manage them. The management of libraries is a pretty in the Northern Cape, for instance, there's vast distances that have to be covered a day. It's the biggest province in terms of sheer landmass, but the most sparsely populated. So kinds of access they are going to be, so that's why the Northern Cape is using mobile libraries.
Thank you.
Perhaps we should ask our director in charge of the culture of reading, I mean in charge of the Center for the Book, to talk bring about to why they're doing that to promote the culture of reading.
Thank you, Honorable Chairman and Honorable Members. There are quite of interventions that we are embarking on in order to encourage the culture of reading in the country. For an example, we are not doing this alone. We are also partnering with other sister organizations such as Times Up to Site Strategy. For an example, in 2009 or 2008, we partnered with Times Up to establish a reading club for commuters from Khayelitsha to Cape Town, because we feel that those people that are commuting in those places should also read. Also, every year we celebrate the World Book Day. For last year, for the first time, we felt that instead of doing it in town, let's take it to the community, to the youth where people are. And it was celebrated in Philippines. And this year it was in Philippines, and we partnered it with the Department of Arts and Culture and Department of Education. And also our poster campaign, because it's always good to have a poster in every child, in every room, to say it reminds one of the importance of reading.
Mm-hmm.
And more than we are also involved in, because there's also a gap, as one honorable member can say, that reading starts in school. And you've noticed that there is a gap there, especially in grade, grade 10 to grade 12. What they like to do most, they read only when they want to pass exams. Besides that, they are not reading. And therefore, we are piloting a reading club now for learners to identify some of the schools. For an example, here in Western Cape, because we are only piloting it now here, we started last year, so that we see how it unfolds. We started with schools in Western Cape at night now, which is about 500 kilometers from here, and Pau. And also, we also identified Portsmouth, because also we want to change inmates there. We also started a reading club in Portsmouth and in schools. There are those interventions that are geared towards eradicating and inculcating a culture of reading. And time and again, we always invite established writers also to talk to the budding writers as well. Thank you, Honorable.
There was a question from Honorable Van der Waal. Where did the 1 billion go? Has it been answered?
Oh, sorry. I want to ask a colleague from the department.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I thought that I had touched on it. Honorable Van der Waal, the funding is, when it was announced, as 1 billion. But it was spread over 3 years. So, as I said, the funding is managed as a conditional grant, Schedule 5, in terms of the Conditional Revenue Act. And it is therefore transferred to provinces. And the provinces are actually implementing the conditional grant. And as I said, in some provinces, the provinces would implement the entire project. Some provinces, like the Western Cape, a large amount of that money would be transferred to municipalities to afford staff, almost 90% of the Western Cape. The same is done in Gauteng, where a large amount of money is transferred to the municipalities to actually even build and appoint staff. So that's how the funding is being managed.
Honorable Van der Waal, 90% of the 1 billion goes to staff.
I want to ask this, because I've raised this in previous terms. If Parliament allocates a conditional grant, there must be control over that grant. And there isn't control. Let me tell you, Chairperson, there is no control what provinces or municipalities, for that matter, does with a conditional grant. And we have to come up with a decision on how are we as a national entity going to make sure that conditional grants are spent on what it is meant for. And control, and I recall very well, and Peter will remember, I once said then they must be punished to the previous minister and not get a grant ever again for 5 years. Give it to somebody else. That's what we should be doing. We've been taken for a ride in government specific. If your salary allocation goes over, I think local government used to be 36-40%, your salary allocation on your total budget, it becomes unhealthy. So if people use a conditional grant that is meant to build facilities for libraries and stock libraries for too much on that, it is wrong. It's absolutely wrong. And I actually think it is illegal. Absolutely wrong. And this committee should know about that. If I may take the opportunity, Chief, and I think we must have an investigation on that. We will propose from the DA. But can I also ask something? on this whole culture of reading, I actually want to ask the presenters. I mean, know, because I read whatever goes on in my province. Not one of us. But here we are, all with huge constituencies that could have taken it to our provincial counterparts and try and assist. It doesn't help if the department has campaigns and the members of the portfolio committee, who actually are supposed to do the oversight of what all entities reporting to us do, don't even get a notice of what we are doing in the department. It's not acceptable. And may I also ask, Chairperson, what are we doing, together with education maybe, to actually popularize?
Excuse me, we are not in the second round.
Oh,
we're still exhausting.
Yeah,
the questions that have been asked.
I think I'll leave.
There was also a question by Honorable Ntapane. What solutions and suggestions do you have concerning what you regard as low salaries? I've not had any response to that one.
If you look at the chapter on implementation, we come very specific. Look very carefully at what we call key function number 18. It's very, very, very difficult for us to prescribe for instance, there's a difference in terms of how provinces pay librarians. Why that is so, we can't tell. You find that in the Western Cape, librarians are paid much higher than in the Northern Cape. Even housing, particularly in better resource provinces, they tend to get higher pay than Northern Cape or in provinces. How to control that is difficult. That's why we talk about overlapping money. Whether the Department of Education can intervene directly, whether it's within its competence to do so, we don't know. But that's the problem.
In other words, we know you cannot prescribe, but it would not be out of order to make suggestions to assist the committee, which, as you know now, according to the money bill, has a muscle to flex when it comes to budget. So, together, we can look for solutions.
Thank
you. So, in other words, I'm saying, if for now you don't have suggestions and proposals to the committee, it's not out of order when you're gone to submit something in writing, making suggestions that can help the committee, help the relevant department.
But I want to go back, if you look at the chapter on implementation. You look at key function 18. The column number 4, that deals with the recommended implementation strategy. We say that if you give the ESSAD Association statutory power, it will then provide norms and standards, even in terms of that. But just now it's just a voluntary association, it doesn't have much power. Yeah, I think there's a very specific question about the control of the core of the Queen's product. I think we were just wondering.
Thank you, Honorable Members. The Division of Revenue Act sets the framework for managing the condition. It outlines specific responsibilities of the department as a national transferring department. It also outlines specific responsibilities of provinces and municipalities. And from that, there are project managers in provinces who are overseeing the implementation of the And it is very clear in terms of the act that you may not spend the money on anything else other than what it was intended. We have made an arrangement in the department that if a province wants to shift funding from one particular item to another, for instance, they want to shift funding from an ICT project to a building another, they have to inform the DG. So they have to write to the department to say that this is what we would like to do, and we request permission to do that. The DG will consider that and interact with the National Treasury and respond to that particular problem. So that is the arrangement that we have in place. Thank you.
That's one of the suggestions and proposals that can assist the committee. And while between now and the time you have statutory powers, we will still expect suggestions and proposals in the short term and medium term, so that we can deal with these challenges. A very serious one. If the average is 2.2 functioning libraries, and the 90% still goes to salaries, that means in the interim we must find some way to extinguish this fire. We're taking the second round of questions. Honorable Van der Valk, you were the first. You don't have.
I
missed
my
turn. Okay. Honorable Lotman.
Thank you, Chair. First of all, I think I would also just like to support the idea that we do have to have a serious look at the community libraries and the conditional grants, and I know the representative from DAC said that there have been some successes or changes and in fact, I think we need a thorough report on exactly what has happened there. Then I would like to ask Professor Nkundo, you referred to a KPMG report and audit. Was that on community libraries?
Yes.
And is that report available? I think that could also assist to a large extent with these questions we do have.
It is available on the...
Excuse me, let's take that question. Then we'll come to it. More questions, Honorable Nance? Yes, Honorable Tungel.
Yes, I think mine has been sort of addressed to a certain extent. Honorable Tikela, Honorable Chair, Tikela.
How much school fees do I pay for that?
Of course, it is not legal. Yes.
And what's your first name, by the way?
Pumele.
And if I say Honorable Pumele, there won't be problems.
No, no, no. That's my name.
Okay.
Thank you. Okay, mine is, you know, I would like to say that mine has already been dealt with, but I would like, you know, some sort of elaboration on the question of eradication of inequality in this sector. That's all I wanted.
Thank you, Honorable Man. More questions? Honorable Man,
yeah, I'm just going to
protest.
You're going to protest? Yeah. I have my hand up before Honorable Van der Waals. And before Honorable Lottery. Hey, now I'm going to protest.
Please don't take me to the
inquiry. No, that's fine. Actually, not questions, but for it to, I don't know whether this would be an excellent proposal, recommendation, suggestion, or whatever. Firstly, just to add on what Honorable Panamas said earlier, with regard to popularizing these campaigns that
ladies and gentlemen. You know, we have our constituency offices, you know, which they take advantage of and use and popularize it. And I think it's all of us responsibility to inculcate this culture of greeting, not only yours. You are leading us in this, but I think we all have a responsibility to contribute to this.
What is the slogan?
Best learning nation.
Informed.
I think we all have a responsibility to contribute to it. And, you know, a reason this is actually linked to what I just said. A reason hasn't really just started to school like that. I remember when my kids were young, I would buy them toys, and within 2 days, I mean, every toy that I bought would be broken. So I decided that I would buy them books out. You know? And that's when I started. By reading to them first, and when they were able to speak. And that helped a lot, because when I would go with them to town, they would ask me to drop them off at CMA. And I'd leave them at CMA and I'd go to my, whatever I was doing in town. But I think, you know, to involve communities broadly, and that would really help a lot. And with regard to the career that I'm, or profession that I'm, not a career, I think this also needs to be popularized, maybe amongst your campaigns to visit schools, not just to talk about the reading, but the importance of career, librarianship as a career, not just schools, even universities. But I think if we start at a school level, probably just by the time people go to university, they've already decided what it is that they want to do. Yeah, I think that's awesome.
Honorable Manuel, I'm giving you another opportunity to compensate for overlooking. Honorable Lopez.
Thank you, Chair. Just quickly to add on to what Honorable Madaleki has said in terms of the reading clubs or the book clubs, you mentioned earlier that you're going to look at book clubs for teenagers to get them reading. I remember last year in her budget speech, the minister referred to creating book clubs all over. So, if you have any reports that you have on that, as it happened, of people reading more, and then also don't forget about teachers as agents of getting people to read. I think to a large extent, teachers inculcate a love for reading as well in their classes. But then I would also just like to ask, and something that worries me on reading this document and the school shortages, and also the fact that you mentioned that non-librarians are appointed. Now, it's fine perhaps for someone like that to do some of the functions within a library, but who takes responsibility for acquiring new material, for cataloguing all those very specific professional functions? Is it just not happening, or how is it
dealt with? Honorable Chivasa, and that will be the last question for now, and then Honorable Malulet, we must remember we have 10 salvation. Honorable Chivasa, Honorable Malulet.
Thank you, I believe my question was never answered, because I know that it is for both areas. The translation which I refer to the dictionary. I know that it's both this time. And it's still offset, maybe if we have an answer, I can come back.
Thank you.
I think I'm just abusing your time. You know, I want to go back to we've already been told about the initiative to encourage people to use, like this train initiative. But what Honorable Mumalo said is that it, you know, we assume that everybody who is not to school, everybody who is not necessarily a learner can read. And it's not always the case. You know, there are people who are very well qualified, but who can't really read. You know? And I'm not talking about any member here, but I can tell you that there are members of parliament who can't really read. So I think it's a very serious problem. In our society, as I think one gentleman has said it, that people read to pass, and outside that, there's nothing, and that actually affects whatever profession they qualified for, because one has to have some general knowledge about the world. You can't just go and study for a teacher's diploma. Some teachers have their own challenges, really. You know, not because they're teachers, they can read, they can't. Some of them can't. I just wanted to emphasize the seriousness of the work that LIS is doing and what, how great the challenge is.
Thank you. Please,
respond.
Thank you very much, again. I think on a report on the community library audit done by KPMG and where it can be found, let me ask our friend from that.
Thanks, Honorable Members. The report is available on the DAC website as we speak. If you go to the website under publication, you will see all the reports.
The question on how to eradication of inequality, I think that's where we make a very, very strong point in the charter, that unless we have unless we have a framework for the determination of norms and standards, it's very, very difficult for us to redress inequality, because it's only in relation to the norm that we can begin to project accordingly. I mean, in the absence of non-standards, it's very difficult for us, very difficult focus for the department to deal with the problem of inequality. So I think that is fair. And that's why we make a very, very strong opinion, particularly with school items. The problem we have there, if you look at the section on university libraries, we had a very, very, very difficult session here in Cape Town with academic librarians, because they tend to fall back on university autonomy, that you can go and force university to fund it in a way. So we are stuck there, and I don't know how perhaps the committee can come with ways in which one can overcome the autonomy question, which in some cases is used to delay transformation. So I think that is a very sticky point when it comes to university libraries.
Prof. Nkondo, again, on such issues, your suggestions and recommendations will be.
Okay, let me talk briefly about culture of reading. We have identified a lot of, you know, ways in which we can do. I think we also want to appreciate the recommendations from other members. You know, the broad-based coalition is important here to deal with the question of problems. But Honorable Chair, there's a problem here which we raised, but perhaps not that fully. That there is a relationship between between how we teach our kids in the school, how we evaluate them, and cultivate it. If the teaching is textbook oriented, then you come to the textbook and say, to pass you need to master the material in this textbook. And there's no way in which the students are required to refer to other materials. Then you're creating, you know, a culture, a textbook culture, which inhibits the larger curiosity of a reading. I think it is. Also, if the examination question has to do with materials as they appear in the textbook, then you kill the kind of curiosity in the idea, you know. So I think we want, this is very, apart from the other strategies, we must require an assessment of modes of teaching and modes of assessment, and see exactly how they relate or don't relate to cultural reading. And that's important.
I want to ask my colleague
Ms. Morris to talk about the professionalizing of the Akumanotan.
Thank you, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members. There was a question about how the non-professional librarians perform the professional duties. Unfortunately, it does not happen, and it has led to low quality service in our libraries. For example, as a library association, we are dealing every day with incidents where libraries are in such a disarray that accessing information is impossible, because the people who are expected to do library work do not know how to go about organizing information in such a way that it is accessible. There was an example of a high court in Gauteng in which the library is in such a state that the judges are unable to make decisions accessing reports because the library is in a disorderly fashion. And it was found that the person who is managing the library is not a librarian and therefore does not know how to organize that information in such a way that it is accessible. So this is a very, very serious situation, because much as we put a non-library professionals just to issue out books, there are also functions which are needed to make those books accessible. They should be cataloged, they should be classified, they should be indexed, and those duties can also be done, can only be done by a trained librarian who would know how to go about it. Unfortunately, the situation is such that when a person who's not a librarian manages the library, there's only disorder. Thank you.
And just to add that we've also found that, I think you have put a very important question, who selects learning materials? That's a very important question. We found out that in some school level computer library, you find there are books there on, you know, Cicero. There are books on Otto von Bismarck, Russian book, in Toyando or Dian. You want exactly how these books are relevant to contemporary needs in this country. So there is a disjuncture there, who selects the book. So we are recommending a greater coordination between the librarians and the users. There is no such coordination now.
Thank you, and thank you, Honorable Chair. The minister, I think it was this year or last year, made reference to the establishment of book clubs in the department, and she also made reference to the government of a booklet, information booklet. Yesterday we received this information booklet from the Department of Arts and Culture, which people is the role of the book club, and I understand that the book club has already is up and running in the Department of Arts and Culture. Every Wednesday they meet, but Mr. Mahala, who is in charge of the department of the project itself, is not here with us, but he gave us this booklet, so at least there is a talk that the booklet is running in the department that the minister has said to.
And just finally, Honorable Chair, on the problem of translators. You may be aware we were, apart from, you know, before we worked on the charter, we were asked to put together a charter on national heritage, the heritage and the national heritage charter. I'm sure it will be coming here before long. In that charter, we said this charter should be translated into all the official languages of the country. And we, at the beginning, we had an agreement that the office of the CEO in Pensa will do it. But it has been difficult for that to be done. We don't know exactly why. It's a problem with Pensa when it comes to translating materials from this school. Secondly, we approached the DAG itself, because DAG within itself has opportunities and things of translating. So I think we have made a request that these charters should be translated into all the languages.
Pencil, do you want to respond to that?
Yes, please.
I could see you flexing your six pack.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. I think I can respond to that. It is not the responsibility of the Transport African Languages Board to do translation, but it is the language services of the Department of Arts and Culture, just to put that in context. Thank you.
Well, Chair, the former CEO agreed to undertake the task. Thank you.
Okay. There's no need for Third World War. The portfolio committee will attend to that challenge. And we have got influence from the department. It might end up forcing some people to do what they don't want. Or differently. Now, I'm not asking questions, making comments. Where I ask a question, I've indicated a question. You have indicated this challenge and lack of national policy, lack of nonsense standards. This is one of the areas where you can make a very clear written suggestion to the committee. You've mentioned some lacuna in the area of legislation, and you're working on something. We are legislators here. We deal with legislation. So please don't lose sight of this. Make sure that we're properly informed so that we can also assist in pushing this area. I think we also agree that inculcating the spirit of a reading culture is the responsibility of all of us, led by you. it has never been brought this harshly to me that we have such a low percentage of functional libraries. I think it's a challenge that we as a portfolio committee will take up very, very serious. And in the manifesto, we talk about transformation and rural development. So there's no sense in which you can really develop the area unless you also attend to this issue. Now, you talk about the vision is towards the best informed nation, and yet, from time to time, we are the most illiterate country in many areas, reading, numeracy, you name it, mathematics, and that kind of thing. And this is a question, how do you marry the two? With the champions in illiteracy, in numeracy, you name it. And how long will it take us to that vision, really? Do you have faith to say, in 5 years' time, in 10 years' time, this is how we're going to move? It is almost unthinkable for me to achieve that vision when we are where we are. You talked about underfunding for libraries. And yet you mentioned no budget, you've not shared with us the Auditor General's opinion about yourselves, and what he says about this 90% of earmarked funds that go to salaries and that kind of thing. What is the AG's opinion about your good selves in this area? And then, again, I repeat, you should be able to indicate in which way this portfolio committee should help you to make this a fruitful discussion. We need to have a program, a way forward, working together. Another interesting thing is we are the president of this International Library Association. What attracted the world to us with our very low performance? I think we should be regarded as a failure, and now we're taken to be made leaders when we actually practically on the ground with nothing to show at home, or very little to show for that matter. We talked about community libraries, school libraries. What other categories have we not mentioned? Are there no private libraries or other categories? You never mentioned reading contests and competitions as part of incentives and motivations. Is this happening anywhere? If not, why not? And indeed, I mean, we should appreciate these partnerships you have with PANSAL, with the Department of Arts and Culture, Department of Education, bringing the relevant stakeholders, NGOs. It's critical because the challenge is so big that one cannot do it alone. We need to bring on board everybody who matters. You mentioned failure to address historical inequalities. It's a huge challenge, this one. And I believe that members are raring to go into this matter. It's completely unacceptable. And thank you for that information. No national school library policy except KZN. What is your interaction with the provinces and what do they say? these provinces that are not moved? And what is the response of the national department when you raise this issue? But not so long ago, the department presented four pieces of legislation, one of which is dealing with the issue of program to make sure that every community has a library. Are you aware of that? You mentioned that Liasa needs statutory powers, but you did not really go into detail. I think the committee will appreciate it if we get some documentation on that and the rationale behind that. And you've mentioned that in some areas there's very poor selection process for books that we find in the library, what one would really regard as fruitless expenditure. If you go out there and buy for the sake of buying, and it's a big challenge because resources are limited. So it's critical that what you have goes to buy what you really need. Except if those are donations, maybe they are donations. That's all I want to raise. Just respond to those to the questions and the other issues. Please follow up so that you assist this committee.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. Again, thanks, colleagues. Let me just address comprehensively how we recommend moving forward. That the 20 functions, the key food and key challenges that are identified. In this chart, it was impossible to have a step-by-step action plan on each of those challenges. It was to recommend going forward that the department should have a challenge-specific action plan. For example, if you say the cut of it, you come out with an action plan that focuses on instead of the problem with mobile libraries. So at an implementation level, there must be a challenge-specific strategy. I think we could make that case that things are important. It was impossible for us to do it in a complex challenge. So that's first one. Let me talk about the vision. We say somewhere this is an aspirational document, what we suggest should be achieved. But at the same time, we're honest to say these are the problems that make it difficult for us to achieve the vision. I don't suggest how we can achieve the vision. There are a lot of problems there. It's not just a matter of resources. The matter of attitude of the maladministration, a lack of a proper sense of strategic priorities in the new dispensation. We have a whole set of factors to be considered moving forward. We should not just be preoccupied with resources, lack of funding. There are other dimensions that make it difficult for us to make good use even of the resources that we have now. And we do identify those resources. But as I said, each one of those challenges must have its own implementation. The Inca president, I don't know the internal politics.
Thank you, Honorable Chair, member. The question was what attracted the world to
to ask you to already provide them with a leader. Because it is an organization of library associations and organizations, I think in South Africa we do meet the criteria which is met by other organizations and libraries in the world. It's just that what we do is not done completely. We have not yet arrived there, but we are on the way of achieving what other countries are doing. And it's also about the quality of leadership. I must say, for us, it says a lot about the leadership within the sector. Because if the world could see that from South Africa, we can have a leader who can lead the world of libraries internationally, it's a plus point for us, because it says a lot about our quality of leadership.
I thought you would add an element of affirmative action.
Honorable Chair, members,
RIASA has only been recognized internationally roughly about 12, 13 years ago. But 7 years ago, we made a bid for what we called the World Cup for Library, and we won the bid, and we had an international conference in Durban where we had 120 countries represented, and they realized that we're capable of doing it, and that's why they chose one of our own citizens as the leader. Thank you.
Going further forward,
on this one, I think basically what we're trying to say as a committee, let us live up to that elevation. Let's make use of that position internationally to change and transform the situation on the ground so that we can be a model also to other countries. I think we need to take that seriously. All of us are agreed that it's a long, long walk to a satisfactory situation.
On the other library category, if you look at Chapter 4, we deal with the public / community libraries. We have a whole chapter there. Then we have special libraries, which include mobile libraries. we also include, libraries in research institutions, libraries in certain private sector. So we have a section on special libraries, libraries and clinics and hospitals. So we have a whole section on how the problem there is how to manage it. Then we have a section on university libraries. There are also national libraries. South Africa has a national library for the blind, and we also have school libraries. So we have five categories of libraries. Reading contents, Mandra, could
you take that? Thank you, Professor Walter. One of the things that attracted us to Free State this year was precisely that. Because in Free State, they've got a competition that really encourages learners to read and read every day and read for fun. And that competition is called Spelling Bee competition, where all schools in that area are participating in that competition, and where how they do it so interesting that words are called out, and then learners are required to spell those words. Interestingly, Jefferson, in Free State at the World Book Day celebrations, we were sitting there. It was the minister of the current minister of education, Ms. Angie Motshekga, the MEC of education from that province, and other dignitaries. As they were calling names, you cannot believe when I tell you that some of that time, so we could not even spell those words. I'm citing it as an example because, and interestingly, those learners would come up top, spelling nicely those words. So my point is that competition on its own, it encourages those learners to go to those books and do research and read every day. And this year we are planning a competition for those reading clubs that I referred to earlier on. Because the idea there is to encourage those learners not just to read for the sake of reading, to read, to be able to understand, to be able to critique, to be able to read. Because some of them, sadly, and it is important to say, I'm going to pull this course, I can't read this course. So, which is sad, Umutwana can't say, no, I can't read. So we will be getting them together to critique and analyze some of the books that would have chosen for them to critique them. So I'm saying there are some of those competitions and contests that are geared towards encouraging the culture of freedom.
Thank you. When we talk about reading, we should also appear that this is a global problem. It's not just ourselves. Even that the so-called advanced economy, problem with reading. How the problem, you know, has to do with the overwhelming impact of television. We are producing a very strong visual culture. And every day our children see spectacles. They don't have to read. And it's affecting, you know, the reading capacities of children. Secondly, Honorable Chair, the spelling problem. For a number of reasons, the market deliberately misspells certain on people. For example, now instead of saying two, T-W-O, you say two. At a very early age, that impacts on the spelling perceptions of, you know, of students. And this is a global problem. The SMS card also, where words are economically misspelled. So we have a problem there that we deal with going forward. It's a very comprehensive of the global culture that comes with certain technologies. I think we have to highlight that. I think you're right, Honorable Chair, to say this is something that DAC on its own can't do. This is a very huge project. And we do indicate there that this must be an intergovernmental project. But beyond government, the government social partners must come on board. The private sector benefits a lot from it. We have a whole chapter there on expenditure and how the private sector is going to benefit from having an informed nation. So it's not just a government responsibility, it's supposed to even offer the private sector. Even our aid agency, for instance, the World Bank, IMF, should come on board. It's a very expensive project and government cannot be inexpected How do we interact with the project? It's something that we want to do.
I think within the LIS sector, we are interacting with various provinces in order to make sure that we're working together in order to build this culture of reading. Each and every province, for example, have their own there is a program which is very, very interesting in Gauteng, the program of Born to Read, where
they target babies and present them. As soon as the baby is born, the baby is presented with a book, and the mother is expected to read to the baby every day. In order to do that, for the baby to get used to reading all the time, and they hope by so doing will start the culture of reading for a very, very early age. So it is very, very important that for the Library Information Services to be able to achieve its objective of building the best information, provinces should work together in order to build the culture of reading.
Thanks, Prof. and honorable member. I think from the department side, on the issue of collaboration, we work very closely with provinces. We meet with provinces every quarter to discuss plans and review progress. We also established what we call provincial steering committee, and we encourage provinces also at the local level to introduce or establish structures that are able to oversee the coordination and management of the project. Thank you.
Yeah, finally, Honorable Chair, on norms and standards. I think it's not enough to say that every community should have its own library. It's so easy to do, they can put a structure there. But if you look at the UNESCO norms, you go to indicate how many libraries I have for so many people in the community. There are very detailed norms and standards. Building is one thing, but the norms in terms of the number of items, accessibility, and stuff like that, and when it comes to the disabled, the design of the building, all those things are worked out very carefully in the UNESCO protocol.
Honorable members, they've avoided the most important question. What is the Auditor General's opinion about yourselves?
That is the department's nightmare.
Let me say from the 2008-2009, from the point of the conditional grant, the concern from the Auditor General was the under expenditure by some of the provinces. And especially Eastern Cape and but what we have done from the department's point of view is that we have brought in the technical assistance unit from the National Treasury to actually support those two problems. And I think they have done a good work so far, because the expenditure for the two programs has improved significantly. Thank you.
So you don't have a budget yourself?
In the department. I was talking specifically about the conditional grant. At the national level, we do have a budget for coordinating the project. And at the provincial level, provinces also have funding from their own equitable share for the sector.
Do you receive a disclaimer, qualified, unqualified, in your coordinating budget?
No, not so. We have not received the disclaimer.
You're not responding to the question. Be frank, tell us what we want to hear. Why is it difficult? All you need to tell us is that 2009-2010, we got a qualified. Before that, we got unqualified. And like that. That's what the committee needs to know. If we must help you, and interact with the department to assist you, we need to also know how you handle those funds. We cannot assist in the dark.
Well, thanks, Honorable Chair. I think I don't have the latest AG report. I'm
talking from the point of 208-009, and I know the only concern was the issue of under expenditure of provinces.
You're avoiding my question again. This is unqualified disclaimer. Take this committee seriously. We're taking you seriously. Yes, please take us seriously.
I'm not sure. I mean, it's unqualified report, 2008-2009, as far as I know.
Part of your homework, go and write to us exactly what the situation is like. This committee is spending time on you. That's not to harass you. The aim is to assist and work together for the good of our country. So, in conclusion, we want to really appreciate your presentation, your submission. And it's two-way traffic, and we want to treat you with respect. While you're not called honorable, many of you, if not all of you, occupy very important positions in the communities and elsewhere. So we cannot treat you like children. We respect the work you do, and keep it up, and let us work harder, and together let us transform this unacceptable situation, which you yourself have said is unacceptable. And let's not only interact when we call you. If there are issues you want to put before the committee or to write to the committee, feel free to do so. It's your committee. In fact, you have elected us, and we must serve you. Thank you very much. We'll take a 5-minute break, and when we come back, Hansel will be ready to make a presentation. Please submit your documents well in advance so that members, honorable members, can study them in advance. It does help a lot. And it assists us in not asking what you might regard as an informed question, because we'll have gone through the document. So, but thank you for coming. You're welcome. Make your presentation, and I hope your presentation will be more or less the time that we allocated to Nick.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson, Honorable Committee members. We want to thank the Honorable Chairperson for affording us the opportunity to come and update you on the progress of our organization, Ten South African Languages Board. Indeed, this is not our first time that we are called to come and present here, and we are grateful to have this opportunity. On the 11th of May this year, we wrote a letter to seek this kind of audience so that we can come and update you on the latest development within our organization. And coincidentally, we received this letter inviting us to come and appear before the committee to explain or update you on the latest or recent development on the resignation and suspension. But we see this as an opportunity for us just to appraise on what has been happening. There's a lot that has happened. If the honorable committee members recall that when we came as a board in 2008, 1st of June, we found the status quo within the organization in a...
Was it 2008 or 2009?
Eight.
You didn't come in 2009?
The board, yes. And we requested a health audit from the suspended CEO, and then due to to the lack of that audit, we then set a moratorium that nothing should take place within the organizations whilst we want to know exactly what has been going on within the organization. That was followed by suspension of the CEO, who had then suspended the CFO and the senior legal advisor, and the board decided to lift the suspension of the senior legal advisor. And the suspension of the CEO was a cautionary suspension based on the insubordination of that moratorium that was put in place by the board, and also the mismanagement of funds. But today we are here just to update on the progress since we started as the new board, and I will invite our acting CEO to take us through on the progress report, and then we will touch on necessary courses suspension, and also the recent suspension of the senior legal advisor advocate team. We have brought in our labor law specialist, Ms. Mbata, who will also provide this information on the progress in the business course. And the ACO will take us through on the latest development. And then after that, we'll respond to questions. Thank you.
What's the title of your neighbor on your list?
The title of my neighbor is a Professor Zodwa Mota, who is the deputy chair of the board.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair President, Honorable members of the committee. The Chair has mandated me to just speak on the outside of the two briefings around the suspension of the senior legal advisor and the suspension of the CEO, to just speak on the progress we have made, Chair President, Honorable members, since we appeared in this committee. And we have a document there that speaks to the progress of TENSAP, a three-page document, which I really want to summarize for the benefit of the committee. The first aspect responds directly to what the Chair has been asking repeatedly here. What does the Auditor General of South Africa say about our report? We were here the last time to celebrate the fact that we have moved from a disclaimer of opinion into an unqualified audit opinion. Last week we had an internal audit meeting, where I still get the sense, Chair and Honorable Members, that this organization would once again receive an unqualified audit opinion, based on the fact that in all our submissions, the AG has found no fault, but we are awaiting that report. There are quite a number of things which we have attended to, because to receive an unqualified audit opinion does not mean we then do not have to attend to certain matters that relate to improving the organization. At the time we had come here, this organization had never submitted an annual report in time. And as it stands, this organization has submitted its annual report in time to the AG. There has been no audit committee charter at the Council of the Language Board, Chairperson, and as it stands at the moment, there is an internal audit committee charter that is updated annually. There has also been no internal audit charter in the history of this organization. And as it stands at the moment, there is that charter in the organization. And these are critical issues to the corporate governance of the organization. There has been no governance committee. We have had no coherent structure, no strategy, no coherent strategy at all to deliver on the mandate that the organization has been given. And these things are in our previous reports. And as it stands, the board has approved a 3-year strategy to deliver the mandate of the organization. The board has also approved a coherent stru-
support that particular kind of believer, then these documents are in the file that we have given to the chair and to the rest of the members. And strangely, for all the past years, there hasn't been an annual business plan given by the board to the office of the CEO to say, this is what we want you to deliver for this financial year. And the board has given myself an annual business plan, which we have in the file, to hold the CEO accountable on the deliverables that the board has given to the office. And those things have not existed previously. There have also been no governance committees, and these things are in the report. And as it stands, we have approved our corporate governance structures. We have charters in place, and they are in the file. We have charters in place to say these are the committees that ought to meet. These are the levels at which things are approved. There have been no delegations in the organization, and these things are in the report. And as it stands, we have proper delegations, and the auditor will attest to that in their report. There have been no policies and procedures, and that was in the previous report. And as it stands at the moment, this organization has all policies and procedures in place to enable it to function efficiently. There has never been contracting of employees. There has never been job profiles for employees. In other words, you were unable to assess. There has never been performance assessment of employees. And as it stands, we have all our job profiles, our competency assessments. All employees have contracted with the organization, and we are assessing them quarterly as required. And that enables us as well to attend to their training needs, which have never been done before. And going towards the end, in our last financial statement, despite the fact that we had received an unqualified audit opinion, financial irregularities were reported by the AG, including fruitless expenditure. And as it stands, there are no financial irregularities in this organization. There is no fruitless expenditure reported in our annual financial statement that we have submitted to the AG. At some point in time, we appeared to scope the staff turnover in the organization was 57%, and it is recorded at the moment only at 5%. Due to the lack of funding, we've been coming to the committee to present ourselves in terms of our challenges, in terms of funding, but we have also taken an initiative on our side to produce a resource mobilization strategy for all those critical projects that have not been catered through the budget that we have been given. All that is in place. Performance procedure, we now have performance procedure in terms of how we coordinate projects in the organization, all that is in place. There was no risk committee in the organization, a critical component of the organization. And as things stand at the moment, there is a risk committee that is integrated within the audit committee. And these are some of the things that we have attended to since we had appeared in this committee, priding ourselves of an unqualified audit opinion. And what we want to say to this committee is that despite all media reports about the state of the organization, the contrary is true. This organization is not only stable, it is well managed, and it is improving itself from time to time. Last week, I attended the National Business Awards, where this organization was nominated and shortlisted as one of the best performing agencies in government. I wish to stop at that little question.
Thank you very much, Excellency. I think honorable members will notice that we have included the 3-year strategic plan in the file from 2010 to 2013, and we have the business plan from 2010 to 2011, which is also included. And also, we have developed, the board has approved a high-level organizational structure whereby today, organigram is also included in the file, and I do apologize for not providing you with the information well in advance for the board members to prove it. I will now invite Mr. Mbanda to take us through on the progress report on the disciplinary hearing of our suspended CEO, Mrs. N.R. Ngozi. Over to you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members. As it's been indicated, my name is Mike Mbada. I am ending the disciplinary process of Ms. Ngozi, who has been suspended. Mr. Chair, the Board of PENSA, in their meeting of the 19th and 20th of February,
We don't say Mr. Chair. We say Honorable Chair, Honorable Member. That's the protocol language of the institution.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. You will forgive me for that. I'm not used to those protocols. Honorable Chair, the Board of PENSA in their meeting of the 19th and 20th of February 2009, they have taken a decision to suspend their CEO, Mr. Ngozi. The reason being that she has defied the board instruction on a moratorium that there shouldn't be any disciplinary steps taken, as the professor has already indicated the reason why there was such a moratorium. The CEO defied that and suspended the head of legal services, Advocate Freddy. And also included in that suspension was the reasons of the investigation, which the board has approved that a forensic investigation to the finances of the organization should be conducted. That forensic investigation was conducted by Ngongi. Ngongi, the Chartered Accountants and Forensic Investigators Organization based in Johannesburg. They have submitted the preliminary report to PENSA in August 2009, and their final report was submitted on the 4th of September 2009. Now, Honorable Chair, as you would know, the issues of disciplinary hearing, especially where a member of staff is under suspension, we always advise that such disciplinary action should be taken promptly. So what PENSA then did, appointed me to initiate the disciplinary hearing of Ms. Ngozi. When we received the preliminary report, we immediately took steps to draft charges because the report found that there were financial irregularities, and we started drafting the charge sheet with the preliminary report, awaiting for the final report. Ngongi indicated to us that the final report will be presented to us on the 4th of September. Now, what we then did, we served Ms. Ngozi with the preliminary disciplinary hearing charges to appear to the disciplinary hearing on the 4th of September, which was the day that the final report was presented to us. We did so, Mr. Chair, in order to make sure that we speed up the Honorable Chair, excuse me again. We did so in order to speed up the process. On the 4th of September, because that day we were presented with a final report, we gave Ms. Ngozi and her attorney all the information, all the reports and the evidence that we were going to rely on going forward with her case. And also because that was the day that we received the final report, we also had to consider if there were any other charges that we would want to include when we received the final report. Then the matter was then postponed until the 7th of November, 7th, 8th, and 9th of November. Honorable Chair, we had to postpone it for 3 days. Our intention was to put the matter for 2 weeks, but the reality is that the matter could not be finalized in 3 days. The amount of charges that were put against Ms. Ngozi on the 4th of September was 46, and on the 7th of November they were already at 56. Currently there are 56 charges against her. Now, Honorable Chair, on the 7th of November, sorry, on the 4th of November, actually not 7th, on the 4th of November, we then appeared again before the Chairperson of the disciplinary hearing. On the day, Ms. Ngozi was not present. She submitted through her lawyer a medical certificate to say she was not well, she was involved in an accident, which the lawyer refused to inform us as to when did the accident take place. Then we had no choice, Mr. Chair. One of the reasons is that, Honorable Chair, we had no choice but to postpone the matter because it's one of her rights to be present in a disciplinary hearing, especially if she submitted a medical certificate. We are not medical practitioners. We cannot question that certificate whether it's valid or not. So we postponed the matter until the 7th, 8th, and 9th of December 2009. On the 7th of December 2009, once again, Honorable Chair Ms. Ngosi was not present in the disciplinary hearing. And her lawyer had submitted an application to the High Court to wherein she cited all the board members and the Honorable Minister of Arts and Culture as a respondent. Their case was that they seek the court to declare the Board of Transport as an unconstitutional. Also that the decision by the board to suspend it to be set aside, and also to interdict the board from proceeding with the disciplinary hearing and lifting up her suspension. As a result, her lawyer applied for a postponement of the matter pending the outcome in the High Court. Honorable Chin, we objected to the postponement of the matter because it was my view that there was no reason to postpone the matter on the basis of an application, and that the case can only be stopped if there was a court order wherein the court ordered the employer not to continue the disciplinary hearing pending the outcome of the High Court, and there was no such. Honorable Chair, the chairperson of a disciplinary hearing, of course, he was mandated to make decisions in the disciplinary hearing. He postponed the disciplinary hearing. In the document which I've presented, I've bolded that there is what the chairperson of the disciplinary hearing has said. I would read, quoting Honorable Chair, he says, well, in the light of the court application, it would appear that it's seeking postponement. I'm saying this is what got arrested from the transcript, Honorable Chair, is to challenge the constitution of the board on the issues to suspend, and this will affect these proceedings. So in the light of the application made by Mr. Ramos, Mr. Ramos, Honorable Chair, was the lawyer appearing for Mr. Corsi. I'll repeat that one. So in the light of the application made by Mr. Ramos for postponement, I would like that it will be warranted to postpone the matter pending the finalization of the application before court, or pending any other decision that will be taken by the board in the interim court. Mr. Chair, those are the reasons. Honorable Chair, those are the reasons that were given by the chairperson of the board. Now, my understanding as the employer representative that the chairperson's reason for postponing is either the employer would agree to postpone the matter pending the finalization of the High Court application, or the board can make any other decision. I was requested by the board of Transam to brief them on the matter. I briefed them, and I've also interpreted what I understood as the reason for the postponement by the chairperson of the board. Then the board took a decision through its chairperson to put the matter on the roll for the 22nd of February 2010. Now, Honorable Chair, on the 22nd of February 2010, Ms. Nkosi, the lawyer, was not present. She was accompanied by a counsel for the benefit of everyone is an advocate that is briefed by the lawyer to represent its client. When we started, the counsel for Ms. Nkosi argued that the had no right to put the matter on the roll because it was postponed pending the outcome of the High Court. It has been my argument that that is not correct, because the reason for the postponement were in twofold. One, pending the outcome of the High Court. Secondly, pending any decision to be taken by the board. And then, therefore, that the board has used its discretion by taking any decision, and therefore the decision was to put the matter on the roll for the 22nd of February. Then, Honorable Chair, the council then argued further that then, even if that was the case, then the reason for the chairperson was then that the board should make such a decision, but the decision was then taken by the chairperson of the board, but not the board that was sitting in a meeting. Honorable Chair, it was my argument further than that the chairperson of the board was indeed mandated by the board to deal with any disciplinary matters, especially in the matter of Ms. Ngozi, and also the Pensum Act clearly indicates that the chairperson of the board represents the board. The chairperson then decided to postpone the matter or give the parties an opportunity to present legal arguments on the basis of the Pensum Act. Now, we then postponed the matter until on the 4th of March 2010. The matter was then set to set for the parties to present the legal argument. Honorable Chair, when the matter appeared before the chairperson on the 4th of March, the lawyer for Ms. Ngozi was then present, accompanied by the same counsel. On their arrival, Honorable Chair, then they argued further that the reasons which were presented with the reasonable postponement of the 2nd of December were not those reasons that the chairperson postponed the matter for once again. So they re-argued the same argument which was already decided on the 22nd of February, and the unfortunate situation was that the chairperson of the disciplinary hearing allowed these arguments and wanted to listen to these arguments. Well, it was my argument that we cannot go back. Today's matter was set for legal argument on the basis of the Act, which I referred to, that empowers the chairperson of the board to take the disciplinary steps against the CEO. Then, whatever happened, Honorable Chair, having allowed them to make that argument, and they further argued the authenticity of the recording that we presented on the 22nd of February in the hearing, just to prove the point that the chairperson did indeed indicate that pending the decision of the board. They requested transcripts. They requested the original recordings, and they said they want to take it to a professional for authentication of that recording to make sure that there was no tampering with the recording. So the chairperson once again granted them a postponement. I then had to protest against the postponement, Honorable Chair, because for me the indication was clear that they were not interested in ensuring that this matter is finalized as the employer was keen. I need also to mention to the Honorable Chair and the Honorable Members that as from the 4th of November, that when the case was set, the employer had always been ready to continue. The employer had already lined up its witnesses and the evidence that was already presented to Ms. Ngozi and her lawyer. So I raised this issue to the chairperson of the disciplinary hearing to say that it is clear to me that the lawyer for Ms. Ngozi and Ms. Ngozi are not interested to see this matter being finalized. And the lawyer actually put it straightforward and said to me, Mr. Mbada, you got it as wrong. Our intention is to make sure that this matter doesn't continue, doesn't happen. So that is their intention. Then, Madam Chair, Honorable Commissioner, I had to advise, Honorable Chairperson, I had to advise the chairperson of the
in some sacred writing, someone asked, how many times should we forgive? 7 times, and it's told 7 by 70. So you have not even used 10 of the 490.
So I can still continue. Thank you very much, I'll try to avoid it on the book.
No.
It's
the 480.
Okay,
I'm thinking. I'm going
to put you under pressure. Honorable Chair, then I requested the chairperson on the 4th of March that we will not provide a date. As an employer, we will not provide a date for the next meeting. Then the employee, Ms. Nkosi, and her lawyer, then they suggested the 9th of April, where everyone else agreed. Then I said, no, I'm not going to give any date. We can put the matter in the DM. In other words, you can postpone it without having a date. The reason for me to do so, Mr. Honorable Chair, was the fact that it was clear to me that they are not interested in this case, and they've already mentioned that. And then I took it upon myself to ensure that I'm briefing the board on this matter, and that I wanted to advise the board to relook the proceeding that is going forward in this matter. Honorable Chair, I advised the board on the same day, which was the 4th of March, in their meeting, which was fortunate that on that day the board had a meeting as well in Pretoria. I advised the board to apply Schedule 8 of the Code of Good Practice. Now, Honorable Chair, Schedule 8 would assist the board not to be calling in meetings and sitting in with Ms. Ngosi and her lawyer. But what Schedule 8 does is give the employee an opportunity to answer in writing wherever the employee is with their legal advice and submit their response, and then the board will take the decision going forward. Honorable Chair, the board indicated that, okay, they will consider the Schedule 8 in this matter. What then the board did, before you comply or you change the proceedings, the board had to firstly release the chairperson of the disciplinary hearing so that the board can implement the Schedule 8. The board did so. They wrote to the chairperson to say you are hereby released from your duties, and the board intended to follow another form of disciplinary proceedings. Then, Honorable Chair, that before the 9th of April, which in actual fact I failed to mention, that the chairperson of the disciplinary hearing overruled me and said this matter is postponed for 9th April. So I had no choice to comply with that. But then the chairperson was then released of the disciplinary hearing, and then before the board could implement Schedule 8, the head of legal services actually advised the board to give her another opportunity and not to apply Schedule 8. This is what then the board complied with. Then, because of that advice and because of the fact that the board had already released the chairperson of the disciplinary hearing, then the board had to appoint a chairperson to preside on the matter. What then the board decided, okay, right, we will start the matter de novo, and that the chairperson who will be appointed still will have to make decisions on the matters which were raised by the employee. The chairperson or the board, rather than Honorable Chair, appointed Advocate Leduaba to preside on the matter from the 9th of April. The first chairperson was also an Advocate Mbaka, who also was released. Now, on the 9th of April, Honorable Chair, we appeared before Advocate Mpapa, who was presiding on the matter. Then, on that date, the lawyer for Ms. Nkosi was present, and Ms. Nkosi was present. Everyone dressed up very well. And then someone took out his recorder and said, Mr. Chair, I want to put it up front that I do not recognize you, because to me, presiding officer of this case, the Advocate Mpaka, who had informed me that he was removed from this hearing, and that it is my belief that the employer removed him because the employer, because Advocate Mpaka does not follow the mandate of the employer. Honorable Chair, once again, I argue that the fact that the employer had decided to follow another process, it is within the employer's prerogative, as long as the employee is not prejudiced. And the only prejudice in a disciplinary hearing from Honorable Chair is when the employee is not afforded an opportunity to present his or her case. And in this case, the employer at all her rights fully prescribed by the law. Then they decided to put the recorder there. They recorded everything they had said to the chairperson, and then they indicated to the chairperson that we are now leaving. I once again call upon the chairperson to warn them that their departure could be to their prejudice, because if an employee does not appear to a hearing wherein the employee was summoned to appear, then the employer has the right to continue in absentia of the employee. But then, Honorable Chair, because on the 9th of April, the hearing was set then in front of Advocate Mpaka for the legal argument and for the argument on the authenticity of the tape, I then advised that the matter should not continue further than where it was, because they refused to argue, they refused to acknowledge the chairperson, they walked away, and that we could not continue the absentia and present evidence, because it was not for that purpose on the 9th of April. Honorable Chair, what then happened, I once again advised the board to implement Schedule 8. Because it is clear that there is no cooperation from the employee and her lawyer, and the employee, it is within the interest of the employer to ensure that this matter is finalized. I will go back one step, Honorable Chair, that on the trying to get the date now, I mentioned it on the date when the lawyer argued that they went to the High Court. I indicated that then, in that case, it is not the employer who is delaying the proceedings of this matter. It is the employee, and the employer is paying the employee's salary. I will then therefore advise the board to stop the salary, which the board did. As we speak now, she is suspended without salary. Although she's challenging that, there was a labor court matter yesterday. We will only get a briefing when we go back from the state attorney.
Let's correct that part. She was suspended. Rather, the salary was suspended, but she challenged it and successfully at the labor court. So she's still with the salary based on an order of the court.
All right, thank you, Honorable Chair. That was not the information which I had. Oh, I knew that the salary was stopped. I apologize for that information. What I then did, Honorable Chair, advised the board to implement Schedule 8 of the Code of Good Practice, which then the board did. The board continued to appoint Advocate Mpaka to manage, Advocate Dwaba, to manage the Schedule 8 proceedings. Now, what Advocate Mpaka then did, Honorable Chair, he presented us with a schedule on how the matter should progress. He ordered in the directive which he gave to both parties, with the employer and Ms. Nkosi's attorney, that the employer must submit the statement of claim, including the evidence. Now, the statement of claim is what is the case of the employer. what is the employer saying? What is it that the employer is claiming is going to have done? He gave us a date of the 21st of May, which I think 2 weeks back, or last week, 21st May, which was on a Friday, for us to submit that statement of claim. Honorable Chen, we submitted the statement of claim to the lawyers of Ms. Ngosi, and the brief was submitted to Advocate Dwala, as he's called it. And then he further ordered in his directive that the employee has got time until the 4th of June 2010, which is on Friday, to respond to our statement of claim and evidence. He then indicated that on the 11th of June, if the employer intends to reply to the response of Ms. Nkosi, then we should do so by the 11th of June. He further indicated, the Honorable Chair, that once we reply, then you provide the parties with time until the 25th of June to present closing arguments. Now, the closing argument is a statement which you present to the chairperson, where you ask the chairperson to believe your case and make findings as per your case or your request. So, all in all, Honorable Chair, in this matter, I just want to reiterate that the employer acted promptly in time, and that the employer has always been available to ensure that this matter is finalized. And it is also on the call of the employer that now we are in this progress by ensuring that this matter continues on schedule 8. There have been no objections from Ms. Ngosi and her lawyer to the implementation of schedule 8. Rather, Honorable Chair, what they then did when they received these instructions from Advocate Dwala, they made a proposal to the employer to say, well, in that case, first they must indicate also that she didn't change her lawyer. She went to appoint a new lawyer, interesting enough, an ex-employee of Pennsylvania. When they received this directive from Advocate Dwala, then they said, okay, right, we've got a proposal to make. They said, okay, can send the proposal. Then their proposal, Honorable Chair, was simple, that the parties should agree to appoint an arbitrator, that the arbitrator should be a senior counsel. My senior counsel is a practicing attorney who is not less than 10 years in practice as an advocate. Secondly, if then the senior counsel, after making findings, any party that is not satisfied with the findings should then appeal. That the appeal, that the party should also agree to appoint two senior counsels to consider the appeal. And then thereafter, parties would have to go for arbitration, wherever parties not satisfied, which the employer doesn't have that leverage of going for arbitration. And the employer only goes to arbitration by call from the employee, who will then be an applicant to the CCMA. I advise the board, once again, that the proposal by Ms. Ngozi's lawyer is nothing else but to revert back to a disciplinary hearing. Because Section 188A of the Labor Relations Act clearly states that if parties agree on an arbitration, the parties should complete a form and submit to the CCMA. And say that the employer must pay for that arbitration. Once you go through the arbitration, there is no process of an appeal. From the arbitration, you have to go to the labor court for review. So what they proposed was not that, which if it was that, it would actually then, they would have been assisting us in ensuring that there's a progress. Because if you go for arbitration, then there is a progress. But that's not what they wanted. We then objected to that because it's actually similar to the process which the employer abandoned of the disciplinary hearing. All in all, Honorable Chair, we are now waiting for the employee to submit her response to our claim. Thank you very much.
Thank you. To present your left with 10 minutes on this.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. I think we have provided you with the detailed information on the progress report, and I think we will spend the next 6 minutes just to take you through the recent suspension of the advocate training, which came subsequent to the introduction of the new structure within the organization. And I will hand over to the SNCO Swiftly to update you on this recent suspension. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Just to finalize Mr. Mbado's presentation, the commitment by Advocate De Glover is that from the 25th, he would have provided his findings within 14 days from the 25th to close the matter. We have in the file an update. We felt it necessary because the invite by the committee was saying we should also give an update on disciplinary hearings. And this matter was reported in the paper, so we felt it's necessary that we include it here. Now, we have presented here how the board has given us a 3-year strategy, an annual business plan to implement, and a new structure to implement in the organization. Implementation had then meant that we needed to gravitate people from the old structure into the new structure, do a job grading of the structure, and know which portfolios are vacant, which we have done, which is why we have so many vacancies in that structure. It's as a result of us having gravitated people. So the rest of the positions become vacant then until you have a job grading and cost it and then approach treasury to say this is what is a shortfall in terms of implementation of the structure. Now, on the 8th of April, what the structure has also done was to define who our executive management committee is, which assists the CEO in running the organization. Previously, that executive management committee was constituted ad hoc. It was not as a result of any structure. Now, this is the structure the board has given our office. It was not by my design, but it is a board structure. It is the board that approves the high-level organizational structure. Mine is to implement. Now, on the 8th of April, it was clear to everybody that this structure will be implemented from the 1st of April, which is when the financial year began. Now, on the 8th of April, I appointed acting executive head in those positions that were created because the new structure created business units. The language business unit stands as a component. Corporate services stands as a component. The chief financial officer and supply chain stands as a component. So I appointed acting executive head and then gravitated the CFO to the same position that he was occupying, just like I did with the rest of staff. That did not go well with the senior legal advisor, who presented his dissatisfaction, firstly alleging that I had no right to appoint these people. As an acting CEO, I had no right to appoint these people. Now, clearly, that's a misunderstanding of the processes in the public service. Also rather indicating in all his communication, which we have included for the honorable members, that he should be appointed acting executive head corporate services. He is the person, he is better qualified and so on. Now, whenever I had read on the matter, in my practice, it is the prerogative of the CEO to appoint acting executive heads. There is no process of advertising when you're appointing acting people. It is the prerogative of the CEO. The announcement says it. I'm just giving this background because this is where the problems have started. And this particular background is not given to all the letters that are written and sent to the media and to Parliament, that this has been the main problem, that I deserve to be appointed, not the other person. Yet it is the prerogative of the CEO to appoint acting people. You can only contest thereafter. So that was the main problem. Earlier on, when the board met on the 3rd and 4th of March, it had received anonymous email to the effect that I, as acting chief executive officer, had lied about my qualification when I applied as deputy CEO, and that I did not have a law degree from the University of Delaware in the case. We have established a proof communication that it was the senior legal advisor who wrote that to the board by his own admission. We have also established, which is why ultimately we came to charges, we have also established that beyond the board investigating the matter, because the board investigated, the HR manager investigated the matter, the university confirmed my qualification, the chairperson did his own independent investigation, presented to the board came to meet staff, explained these issues, but beyond that, he has continued to investigate the acting chief executive officer, which is a practice which is not correct. Firstly, you cannot investigate your senior. Secondly, when the board has, when you are claiming to be a whistleblower and the board takes you seriously, it investigates, you cannot continue to investigate. The senior legal advisor continued to investigate. He got a report from LexisNexis about my qualifications on the 11th of May, and on the 12th of May, he wrote to Scopa to say I did not have those qualifications, despite the fact that his own investigation has yielded results to the opposite. Now, there has been an array of allegations which he has brought to the board subsequent to my refusal to relent to his request that he be appointed acting executive head of corporate services. There has been an array of allegations that have been sent to the board. The ex-co of the board took them seriously. We met, and the ex-co of the board took a decision that, look, these things will continue if we do not investigate them. Despite the fact that we can see it is Hogwarts, but let us satisfy the person and investigate these matters. These matters were related to PricewaterhouseCoopers, and they were appointed to investigate these matters. And in that, the board also included the matter of the qualifications, because he had then said, no, no, this gentleman was not investigated properly and so on. So the board relented to that. And that process is costing us no less than 128,000. And these are the expenses we're going into to satisfy all these allegations that are sent to Parliament. After the board had made that commitment, appointed PricewaterhouseCoopers, after the letter in the file, informed both myself and the senior legal advisor. The senior legal advisor continues to write. Now, the emails were taking another turn. He wrote to the chairperson of the audit committee, reporting his lack of confidence in the board, making serious allegations about board members, even where they worked before they came into the organization. And all this communication was written in the letterhead purporting to be coming from the chairperson of the board. Even the letter, subsequent to submitting a letter with all forms of allegations which were being investigated, he submitted it to the Honorable Body of Scopa. This is after knowing that all these allegations are incorrect through his own investigation. We investigated the senior legal advisor and charged him, and the charges are included here, they range from insolence to insubordination. They are basically five charges which are all related to our regulations as an organization. I do not want to get into the detail of what the regulations are saying. We called him into a hearing, which he attended and asked more time. We have given him that time. The next hearing is now set for the 24th of May. And in my capacity as acting CEO, I have met with PricewaterhouseCoopers. The process with the chairperson and the board has started, continued. They have even asked me the question, like, beyond professional advocacy, do you think we should still consult him? I said, by all means. He is entitled to give his own side of the story to PricewaterhouseCoopers. But what an employee is not entitled to do is to continue to rubbish the name of board members, both in their individual and collective capacity, spend my name to spread misinformation, even on letters that were subjected to investigation that were proven to be false. So these are the letters, internal letters of our regulations that no employee, including myself, is beyond the disciplinary code of the organization. We know he has approached many courts, including the CCMA. Thank you, Honourable Chair. He has approached many courts, including the CCMA, which would still come back to us on the fact that he is protected under the Protected Disclosure Act and so on. But we don't believe so. We understand what the Protected Disclosure Act is saying, and it does not protect false information. Thank you, Chair.
Honourable Chair, that's true, correct. The report of mine is already passed.
Yes.
It's the 14th June. The case was determined.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chair. I was just about to correct that the hearing was adjourned until the 14th of June, and it was a blessing in disguise on behalf of the board, because by then I would have received the report from PricewaterhouseCoopers. So I think the 14th of June is the day when the hearing is going to take place. And we want to thank you for the opportunity. This is where our feedback, and thank you.
Honourable Member.
Thank you, Chair. I would like to go back to the suspension of the CEO. The whole process is really, I think, a very unhappy situation and almost untenable, because this is taxpayers' money that is being wasted, and I see in your progress report that the Solicitor General's reports no wasted expenditure, but I think this is a prime example of a person's salary being paid for so long and the process just dragging on and dragging on. And I understand the fact that point is made that the employer has not delayed the process, but the employee. My problem is, however, at this point, I'm not quite sure about the point where this is going to end. Because if I listen to what you say, and the proposals are made in terms of arbitration, which is most definitely not an arbitration process that has been described, where is this going to end? Because somewhere there must be a tougher point. If I just do a quick calculation, I think in terms of salaries, we're talking $1 million excess. And secondly, who's responsible for all the legal fees at this point? And if we look at FAMSAL's budget, I don't think the organization can afford this kind of expense. So what's the prognosis here?
Yes,
Honorable
Tucker.
Thank you. Thank you, Honorable Tucker. I also want to find out from the gentleman next to me, in the papers before the High Court, is there a date for the hearing of the application? No, I'm asking this question because I understand there must have been a lot of money now wasted in appointing these arbitrators. So because my other concern is, if it might happen really in High Court, that the decision of the board to be serious challenging really is questionable, it will affect the division of the association. And why do you prefer not to challenge it? Where it's serious, because I do have a right to approach anyone. Why do you prefer not to follow the court here to approach, that is the High Court?
Honourable.
Thank you, Chair. I would also just like to pick up on the High Court application. Is there any indication in the papers submitted in the application as to what point? I know it's now the composition of the board, but on what basis? Is there any justification why the board was not constituted properly.
Okay, let's handle those three questions.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Thank you, Honorable Member. When, after my presentation, Mr. Sibu had said he wanted to make one final point on my presentation, where he said, through the 25th of June, Advocate Letoma has got 14 days. This is a commitment that he gave. He has 14 days to give us his findings. So, in other words, that the matter will then be finalized, if my calculations are right, on the 4th of 14 days. Let me not try to make it that clear, but 14 days from the 25th, that matter will be finalized. On the issue of taxpayers' money audit, we should understand that if as an employer we do not comply with the laws of this country, I mean, the Labor Relations Act gives their rights and all the things to challenge the letters and so forth. And as an employer, we cannot harshly rush these things because we're worried of the money that the employer might be paying or spending at this point in time. Because if we do not follow the Act, we might spend more. And that could be a danger. I just want to exhaust the Honorable Rakit's questions first before I come to your questions. The challenge in court of the Constitution of the
Board. If I actually hear you correctly previously, that the salary was also suspended initially, but she challenged this and won, and that's why you continue to pay.
All right, and also in that case, Honorable Chair, I indicated that there was a court case on the business of salary, which was yesterday. If I may, Honorable Chair, not my duty to criticize the court at this point in time. We didn't find the logic from the judgment on that case, and then therefore we appealed that. So the state attorney is handling that, and that is not paying the money of that. To this other question, the issue that she contests about the constitutionality of the board is that she says that in its inception, the board, in its first meeting, the board must be sworn in by the Chief Justice. Now, the first meeting of the board was not the first meeting of these board members. That's not what they had said. The very first meeting that the board has been constituted, that meeting was the first meeting of the board. I'm not sure how many meetings after that was the 56th meeting when the board came in. So her argument actually is misplaced. This is our argument on that case. Also, there was issue of legal fees. The employee paying her own legal fees. And we are made to believe that the reason why she had approached the ex-employee was the fact that the lawyer had lost her taxes. They did not take like that.
This ex-employee is also a defendant.
No, he's a lawyer. You must understand how lawyers work. He's a lawyer. No, he's not this client. I'm touching him. Then there was a question by Honorable Ntabane. All right. Your question relates to whether we followed this application in the High Court where she went, and also the indication of when is the date in the High Court. So that is the question correct, sir.
Unconstituted, this board. Don't you feel, therefore, that the decision of the association would be impacted by the decision of the High Court and makes it now a futile exercise wasting more money?
All right. Honorable Chief, honorable members, on the date when the lawyer asked for postponement pending the application in the High Court, the question was raised by the Chief whether this was an urgent application or it was just in a normal course. The application was in a normal course. Also indicate that the Pensac is challenging that or is defending that application. The issue of whether the High Court would impact on the arbitration, it is so. If the court would have found that the board was not very properly constituted as per their argument, that yes, it would, the court can make an order that all the decisions made by the board were actually unconstitutional, and it will let that in a futile exercise. But Honorable Chair, I must indicate that these things that she raised in the this is part of our argument, these things that she raised in court were actually her responsibility. She raised the things that she failed to implement if they were to be implemented, and now using those to her advantage, I do not see that the court will find in such, because if you fail, it cannot benefit you, but it might benefit someone else.
Thank you, Major. And on the High Court matter, well, I think it does need to be clarified even further. But Mrs. Nkosi made this application, and the Spencer we replied to her application. Now, she needed to file another answering affidavit to the High Court in order for the High Court to set a date. She has not done that. So she continues to stall the process through not filing. Now, she could decide not to file for the next 4 years. Now, you can't then, as an employer, park all your processes waiting for her to file an answering affidavit to the High Court. You would then wait forever. That would be a strategy to enforce the contract. So the employer did the right thing by continuing, because if you were, as an employer, to follow her route of parking the disciplinary process pending that, then you would not have it, because she would not file her answering affidavit. There was also a question about the arbitration. I think we need to explain that the board rejected the arbitration process. So as it stands, the matter will be finalized 14 days after the 25th of June, which makes it more definite than wanting other interventions.
Honorable member, I'm sorry about this.
No, don't apologize.
Yeah.
You have the right to ask questions.
No, I've got a concern really, because he has got the right to approach any court. The question is, if you fail, actually, they are fair, he fails to fight at an affidavit. Wouldn't it be cheaper to make an application compelling her to submit other than this long road you are taking, even though there is a set date now for the matter, but wouldn't it be a wise then to make an application to compel her to file your answer and application?
Honorable Lopez?
Yes, I just wanted some clarity. I don't know whether I understand the process correctly. Once again, also relating to the High Court and not signing the affidavit. Now, if we have a conclusion of this process somewhere in July, what is the status if she then files that affidavit? Can that decision then be rescinded? That was taken on
the
situation by
advocate. I wanted to respond by saying the challenging of the status of the board can be done by anyone at any time. even after the conclusion of the disciplinary hearing. In other words, for the board, it, as much as I can say, it is concerning members. We can't compel her to file because, she, for all we know, she could by that very act have withdrawn her case because she is complying fully with the process as set out by Advocate Edwama. So we have no reason to believe that she is pursuing that case. It has been a very long time. But certainly, at any other point in time, any member of society can challenge the constitution of the board, including her in the future. But we are certain that the constitution of the board has been done properly and that the arguments are very faulty.
Maybe we should realize that in law and legal matters, there's no absoluteness of certainty, especially because these decisions are made by other people. So maybe for now, this is the wisest route to follow. And the other bridges, we may cross them when we reach them if they emerge. There was a hint. Honorable
Van der Waal. I'm sorry, I did not sit through the presentation, but I'm quite aware because I was against the appointment in the first place of this person. May I just say this? I'm not sure if it was answered. In a case like this, if the, let's say, the department wins this case, what happens to the legal costs by the individual? Because I would hate to see that government keep on paying legal costs of individuals who are at the wrong. And we see it happen very often. So I'm not sure what the status quo is in this regard. I think we need to know that. And, you know, if you're guilty, sometimes you have to come up and not the government.
I'm feeling that your question is based on the High Court matter, not the disciplinary matter. Normally in High Court, the judge makes that decision. The counsel for the department will have to argue for legal costs for both the counsel and the lawyer that brings to the counsel.
So are you prepared? I mean, I know how the court
makes
the decision, but are we
prepared
to motivate, or
are
we just
going
to let it go?
Your mic is quiet.
So it's just that I want us to be prepared. So we don't just, like happens very often in different departments, we just let it go. We must be clear that if the person is the guilty party, that we actually do not just sit back and take the legal cost, that, you know, that we are prepared to fight, and even if it doesn't come up in a case, that we actually say we want this cost not to be carried by the department. That's the point I'm trying to make. I know how a court case works.
Oh, and I apologize for that, Honourable Member. I think that is for the board to make that decision with the council.
I keep looking at the honourable member in relation to that High Court question, and I believe I realise that there's something else I did not say as well. That even if the High Court were to rule that the board is legitimate, it would not have ruled on her guilt in relation to. The charges. In other words, the process that is happening now would still have had to happen. So it's not either or. So the board is right to have continued with the disciplinary process in this sense, because to postpone it would have meant you would have to come back to it even if the court says you are late to do it. So I just thought I should explain that as well.
Honorable
Honorable Chair, my name is Pumele.
Pumelele, Honorable Pumelele.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. The Chair is human, flesh and blood, and not as infallible as God. So bear with me, Honorable Pumele.
I do bear with you. Umbuzo ngokuba ndide ndiphembu kancinci apha kwi-dictionary.
ezinayo iprovensi. Kukho umba apha ekufumaneka kuyo yonke le nyewe yokokuba owayesakuba ngu-acting CEO ngexesha lakhe lokugqibela. Ndifuna ukwazi i-size yepersonnel uba yayingakanani eyayifunctiona ngelo xesha nangexesha lokuaphoyintwa kwe-acting CEO nangexesha langoku. Qha
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. The organization employs about 76 people. The new structure would obviously have impacted on it in terms of expectations, but in terms of implementation, there hasn't been a filling of the gap since I said it would still be dog grading, so we still employ the same number of people. I think what we have improved, though, is the extent to which we frequently lose our employees from 67% to a 5% start in overage. Thank you, sir.
Honorable.
Thank you, Chair. I would just like to ask a question on the suspension of Askatini. Now, you sent a letter to SCOPA, and Chair, I think it's also very important for us as part of our oversight that we do get the PricewaterhouseCoopers report, because some very serious personal allegations are made in that letter, and it would be, I think, bad for the committee if we don't have access to that information as to the actual veracity of the information.
I think we, Honorable Chair, we receive it in that when once we have the report. Do the consultations amongst the questions? I take it that honorable members don't have questions.
Could I perhaps just ask Mr. Sweden, in the absence of Atta Kasteni, who is dealing with the complaints in terms of language matters?
Thank you very much, honorable member. We have appointed Advocate Adibole as an acting senior legal advisor. She has been there before, Advocate Kenny. She has dealt with the letters before. But also in terms of how our new structure has reconfigured the organization, that's an area we have tried to improve. So we channel all linguistic complaints through the executive head for languages, who then refers them to the legal unit, so that there is tracking of the complaints and that we respond in time to all complaints, and we know exactly where each complaint is, what is the progress on each of them.
Honorable members, we're dealing with a past that's not palatable, and a past which to some degree is still with us and haunting us. But I think page one is good news. The dramatic improvement that collectively you've brought in council, beginning with movement from a disclaimer to an unqualified Auditor General's report.
That says to us that you did not allow these challenges to paralyze you, because paralysis would mean a huge loss to the nation. We need to really congratulate you for that, because as I say, Pan South is very important to the people of South Africa, of all language groups. Language is at the center of our culture. Anybody who paralyzes an instrument that plays that vital role does lots of hurt and damage to the nation. If wishes were horses, I think honorable members have made it very clear, these legal processes would be expedited so that we get everything behind us. That's the challenge of a democracy. It comes with a rise and separation of power. We are not the judiciary. If we were the judiciary, we would find a way to finish this matter within a week. And we're not the executive. I mean, the executive is not the judiciary. I think we need to appreciate that democracy comes with its problem. It's not like in the past you detain, you torture, people tell lies or they tell half truth, or in some cases they tell the truth. That's the burden of democracy. You need to follow all the processes. And I think you're trying to do that. And the encouragement you're getting from the portfolio committee is that do everything within the parameters of the law and regulations to expedite the process and close up the process. Try your best. I hope next time when we invite you, we shall be discussing other matters that matter, real program issues, delivery issues. But that also says to the board, these incidents are a wake-up call, to be alert all the time, and not to await disasters before we respond to certain issues. I'm happy to hear of the internal audit that is now alive, because serious internal auditing would alert you to the problems when they are still very small and you nip them in the bud. I think the board needs to see to that. They say well begun is half done, and this is a good beginning. But once you achieve this status, it's very difficult to keep. You know, when you're champion, everybody wants to bring you down. And sometimes success can lull the board to sleep, and they fail to be more watchful, and when they wake up, they find that their champion has also collapsed. This is very embarrassing. And thank you. I think we definitely need to get that report when it's completed, so that we can also certify ourselves. But at the same time in this country, everybody is regarded as innocent until found guilty. Sometimes newspapers have gotten it right, sometimes they've gotten completely wrong, so that we don't judge one another on the basis of headline stories and that kind of thing. All of us, we need to be very careful. So travel safely, and thank you for the document. Remember your homework. Next time we want these things well in advance so that we can go through them. And homework number 2, delivery of the report as soon as you get it. Thank you. Thank you, Honorable Chair. I don't know whether protocol permits or just to respond to what you just said. And I'll request the Deputy Chair to thank you on our behalf.
Honorable Chair, thank you very much, and thank you to the honorable members. Mine is a very brief message to say we thank you very, very much for allowing us to share with you our house, and we appreciate the words of affirmation. We appreciate every question that was asked and the time that was given to ponder on these questions, because it shows us that your oversight is an important aspect. And we truly promise on behalf of the board and the office that we are going to try to do our mandate, so that when we come here next time, we'll be talking the mandate that has been assigned to do. Honorable Chair, we appreciate your words of affirmation and wisdom.
You are released, and we'll take only 2 minutes of comfort time and come back and finish the agenda.
Thank you.
We are moving to the minute. Thank you. We're looking at the minute of the 98th, page 1.
Recorded last week, Chairperson, I just put an apology in writing. I mentioned last week in my letter, I stated that was out of the ordinary time of this committee meeting time schedule. It was Parliament was already sitting that week, and so I received the notice too late. I don't know what happened to my correspondence, but I just submit a written apology.
To whom did you submit it?
To my secretary.
Yeah,
I don't know what happened to it. But well in advance on the Thursday.
So she didn't submit it to you?
I can provide copies from my secretary if you want
to. Deal with the secretary for failure to submit. Because as we said together that time, there was no apology. Page 2. Page 3.
Yes? I think you're looking at me. I'm wondering what.
No, you're sitting opposite.
Oh,
opposite.
So our eyes can't avoid each other.
Oh, no, we can't.
No, it's just that of the people who are in the meeting, there are only two here. And I keep on asking other people to participate fully in this meeting because it's only the two of you who are in it and the other members. And he proposes to me approval of the minutes.
He's pushing the bar.
He proposes to me and I can't respond.
And page 3. Four. And as I have personally gone through the minutes and I'm satisfied that they've been upgraded. Those who are present, please propose adoption and second. You do. Second. yes, I do. Yeah, but the chairperson is not supposed to do that except if his salary is raised. Thank you. Now, any other business? We are falling seriously behind with our oversight preparation. And I've been pushing the secretary with very little success. But now, yesterday, I did get some drafting that it's not complete. These are the drafts. But they cover all the provinces that we have lined up. What are you distributing?
The draft.
The
Do we intend to do this, to visit this place, to go on overtime?
I think in principle, we decided we want to start with the 2010 issues, and we are going on recess on Thursday. This is the American. Now, what do you suggest?
Can I ask you something else?
Please.
Okay, I fully understand 2010, etc. But if I look at this, I understood oversight of a portfolio committee to be exactly to do oversight on their own entity. Am I right? Now, if I look at this, there's nothing on here except maybe the Thule Museum that are relevant to this committee. Nothing else. Nothing else. Now, I can't see that we can take money from the budget to go on a very nice festival visit, and none of this actually gets anything from this department. I think it's completely wrong. I do not think that that is what we're supposed to do. We've got 28 entities reporting to us, getting funding from us. We've got the National Arts Council stuff that we actually have to go and look maybe at that or stuff like that. I don't know why we're doing this, really. I don't.
A more helpful comment? Honorable Malek?
Yeah, I actually agree with Honorable Panabal, especially with regards to the festivals. We can't do oversight on the festival.
More comments?
I'm honorable there. I felt to differ with my colleague. If the government is putting money into this festival,
I'm protecting your right to speak. He's not the chair that silenced you. Continue.
No. Let me finish. I was saying, if the government puts money in these festivals, which I believe it does in some of them, they have started to open.
Honorable Mamon.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think the day we're discussing about this oversight is we said we want to link this oversight process with the 2010. Maybe we the place that we identify to say we want to do an oversight visit about the 2010. I don't know if I'm wrong or not. I'm subject for correction. Thank you.
Another which one?
Unfortunately, Honorable Chair, I was not there when we were discussing about the festival. Which festival are you there? Are they here?
There are several festivals.
Which one?
There are several festivals. The Kalahari Desert Festival. And I think this is interesting to Oliver Tambo. I'm not in that room. Then there's a Wild Coast SDI Festival. There's a Chris Street Cultural Festival.
So the copies that you have, that information. Honorable Lopez?
Some clarity perhaps. We requested the department to provide us with a list of possible things that we can do oversight on, and they're not specifically entities, but is what we have now part of the list we got from the department, because then it is funding from them involved, as I understand it. I'm not sure.
Honorable Malek?
Yeah. I think it is true that this is, these are festivals that are part of the 2010 program. But what I'm saying is that why I say, you know, we shouldn't necessarily be the festival. Because with what we want from something like this, where the department has put money into, is to look at things which we may not necessarily get at the festival. Because we want to. The only thing we will know if we go to the festival is that the festival was going to be. But I think from something like this, we would like to know how many jobs were created, or whatever, which opportunities were created for the artists with regards to this festival. So and maybe other things. But these are things that we can information. We will not necessarily. I'm just wondering. How will we get that information at the festival?
Honorable members, you are right. If you look at this as the oversight program of this committee, it's a joke of maximum proportion. It's actually tourism. Oversight and monitoring is something very serious. If we submitted this to the powers that must approve, they'll think this committee is playing. And we've been dealing with this thing many times. See, the department came to make presentation on FIFA-related matters, but they also presented their budget vote. We also know their entities. Now, what I think we called upon the Secretary to do is to look at the comprehensive list. We have Robben Island. We've got Freedom Park, we've got the museums, we've got the heritage sites, We've got so many things that are happening, real substantial stuff. I think we'd expected the secretary, he's got all those documents. Following the lineup we did, so that if we're going to Eastern Cape, we can only just be going there to see something only related to Brady Tech. We must look at other things. And so with every province. I did speak with the secretary twice in my office to indicate the mix that we want. It has not happened. And so, Secretary, I think you hear what the members are saying. This committee is being frustrated with the secretary. You are the heartbeat of the committee. So if things are weak with you, you're going to fail the whole committee. He received a list of dates, he said last night, concerning some of these festivals. And the list is broad. You can't read. Even himself cannot read. Do they came in West Texas? Yeah, this is the thing. You see, who can read that? And really, this is communication between secretary of a portfolio committee and the department. This joke is undermining the committee. Just look at it. What can you do with that? Even with the most powerful spectacles, you can't read this book. And it's not even, it's not acceptable. And these things were supposed to be factored into these things. It's not done. And we're going on recess before we go to monitor anything, do oversight on anything. This is not acceptable. And I think the secretary must go and work on that mix of a draft and drop copies in the pigeonholes of honorable members, not later than tomorrow. Not later than tomorrow. I share your frustration. Let's look at the principle. Do committees normally go on oversight during recess? And this is a very special recess when it has. Help me. Honorable Manga?
Yeah, the normally would be to find out the last week or so for oversight, committee week or whatever it is. Yeah. So I think we must just find out which part of this recess is allocated to committee.
Okay, Secretary, could you get that for us, please?
In fact, I think it's the 12th of August, more or less, because Parliament reopens on the 20th, the plenary, and the week before that is committee work. I think it was announced in our caucus.
August,
I mean,
August.
August.
I think I'm coming to
yeah. More or less.
So, you want us to go on oversight before we come back from recess? A week before that?
Committee period.
Committee period.
Let's just establish which is a committee period.
Then we'll use that.
Yeah.
Okay. So, when you drop the proposal in the pigeonholes, also drop that information about committee week.
Can I just add something? This does not stop members who have an interest to go to these festivals or to visit some of these activities that will be taking place that are 2010 related from getting invitations from the department. So if a member is interested in attending, they can always through the secretary just ask the department to give them invitations.
Any other matter? The secretary wants to say something. You hear him?
No, thank you. Can I request make a meeting? As I sit down to my talk for members to actually assist me and guide me and point out that those things they would want from all. Because like it's difficult for me, I think, to look at my members of the board. There may be a number of other things that members of the team prefer than anything else. And I think it should make even the task easier. I have failed, I think, somehow producing, circulating the stuff, because that's just like a file from a document that is presented by the department. And I tried to look at what happened in which province, in the way that provinces were decided, without actually knowing when those activities were taking place. Because like I couldn't leave out the Eastern Cape, and the only thing I could find was a festive. So in trying to, you know, put this thing together in the absence of information, but the information I had requested from the department and the people who put that are actually project managers of 2010. It's difficult to find until this thing only came last night. So I have those challenges. I don't think it's actually difficult to put a program, provided you know what number actually want. They want to go to different centers, and that program, it makes it very easy. But like to try and figure it out, it's a bit of a challenge. Thank you.
Honorable Maluleka, then Honorable Thunderbird.
I think what the secretary needs to do is we've had several presentations of the cycles. The secretary should have an idea which areas are problematic, which entities and institutions we have a problem with. And those are the entities that we really must start with. And pay more attention to those. Give an example. You know, the reason why we called Pan South here was because there was a problem. So we wanted to know what the problem was. So I think what the secretary should look at is, you know, like even Robben Island, you can put it as, on that list. Of here. So just think of all the institutions that are having problems, and we will have to start with those institutions.
Honorable
Time
for lunch.
Yeah, well, we're the same age and the same colour hair, the same sex, so it's fine. And the same party. But, see, I even would propose to make it easier for the secretary. I think there's a list of entities. And what you should do is you should take that list and split it into the relevant provinces where those entities are. Once you've done that, you can know which of those entities have presented to this committee in the last year or whatever, and which ones not. And you can even go further if you have the time to say which one has a bad AG report, qualified or whatever. We know those are the problem ones, and then send out that list to us and we can have a look. Our duty is not to go and visit 2010 activities per se. So that's not part of our oversight. We do oversight over our entities. But whilst we are there,
And there are something of 20 things we should go and visit and maybe see how our artists are being treated and getting exposure, etc. So that's the way to go. We don't go and do festivals. Festivals get money from municipalities and provinces. They not necessarily get money from here, we all know. So I think that's the way to go. Take out 28 entities. I mean, the Northern Flagship got a new name. All the museums and stores got a new name. None of us have been there in the committee. I've been there on my own, and we should go there. So I think that's the way. Take our entities, split it into the provinces, and also say we've got bad reports that we know each other problems for. And if there are dates in the previous report that we got of the committee program, you write there in brackets when they did visit and present to us and when not. So then we can see, we just let out and plan the trip around that.
Go and do that, and it will help the committee. And we're not saying this for the first time. We must be very honest with ourselves. We have mentioned this, and even said we must start with entities which are in troubled waters. I remember the phrase, being used. So let us get that proposal in our pigeonholes by tomorrow. It's not the secretary dictating. From the word go, we said make proposal, and the committee will see what to adopt and what not to adopt. Because I'm saying this because if we get this tomorrow and day after tomorrow we consult and agree, then the secretary can submit an application for that week. That is committee week, and we can go and begin to do our work. Well,
for 6 years.
You want to start that there? Okay. Who has a private plane?
No, we must try to
I'm not saying no, but I'm saying charity begins at home.
Yeah, no.
Let's start at home and then look abroad. When we've done nothing at home.
Okay.
So you're saying he must include Timbuktu in his consideration. Agreed. Thank you, honorable members. And we'll meet again when we go on overtime. And when we come back from this, God bless you.
Thank you, sir. And be safe, sir.
Thank you very much.
We're going to look for a week.
Yeah, on the bio-freelach and the bio-freelach.